Welcome to Dark Bits.
It's just me, Wolf's Substack board man.
Yeah.
Remember her from New Hampshire.
Sure. Yeah, it's been pretty good. Yeah, it's kind of like Eisenstein adjacent.
Yeah, yep. I'm just...
A lot of words, usually.
She is a dense writer. Good writer. I could almost hear E. Michael Jones shouting back at her about Judeo-Christian. It's funny. Term doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, she groups everyone in, and if they give any Bible recognition.
Yeah. Morning, Nick.
Morning. Morning, Josh.
Greetings. 5:01 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, February 25th, 2023.
Is that your tartan behind you, Nick? What is that?
The clan tartan, that is.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I'm the only one in the clan. That's the thing. I hung that up there because there was a bit of glare from the sun, and I don't have any other. I don't have curtains or drapes, so okay. I thought I. Yeah, but it's quite an attractive color, isn't it?
Yeah, it brings out your eyes.
You're so sweet.
Just talking about Naomi Wolf's Substack. Have you had a chance to see that?
No. What she been seeing?
The most recent one had a lot of Bible verses referenced, and much more of the evil versus the light in the world kind of a battle.
Well, I think
it's Christian.
I think so.
She's Jewish.
Oh, she is.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, very Jewish. But I think that the takeaway that Wordman was suggesting was odd in the sense of everyone from various points of view traditionally who would never say things like this is implying that today's times are explained by the reintroduction of daemons or other gods like the Baal, the Astarte, the Moloch, which is unusual in that in better times you didn't hear that sort of argument being made by traditional Jewish or even Christian writers or mainstream folks. And for someone of her stature and status to start talking as though, she belongs on a secret sun blog post or whatever is highly unusual and speaks to, I guess, the level of fear and anxiety people are having over the irrational aspects of what's going on right now. And her premise starts with saying, how did we just do a complete 180 from basically being this is arguable, but her premise is that we were on the right track and doing the right thing. And then all of a sudden we turned away from God and or Jesus, depending on your point of view. Mm-hmm. I would argue that we weren't necessarily so moral for long before COVID and all this totalitarianism hit. But I think it's just her referencing it and alluding to these ancient gods that she claims, then morphed into the Greco-Roman gods. And then we're suppressed and or vanquished by our endorsement and following of either Yahweh or Jesus, depending on your point of view, suppressed or banished those lesser spirits, but that they're dangerous nonetheless, and we were warned against them, and that we've broken our covenant, whether we be Jewish or Christian. Mm-hmm. And all I kept hearing was Michael Jones asking her, is abortion a fundamental Jewish value, and wondering how she'd answer that. Mm-hmm.
Well, has she spoken about abortion?
No. It's a very important topic and discussion that is not brought up enough because it's brought up in the sense of choice and too infrequently brought up in the sense of what about the poor little guy or girl that's trying to be?
Yeah, and the sanctity of life in itself.
Right. So in any event, that's where I think she's off base in her arguments. She gives her as she calls them, her people, a free pass way too easily on all this and basically acts as though it's only a very recent deviation from the covenant where if you look at it from another point of view, like Jones argues, it's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know at what point she thought that the departure from the righteous path was made because – I mean, for example, she very pointedly ducked the whole issue of 9/11 when she was asked about it. Yeah. And obviously, you know, any implication that there might have been Israeli or Mossad involvement in that, you know, clearly that was not a subject that she could entertain.
Sure.
So skirt around that one. So I wonder where she, you know, where she regards this this the fork in the road, you know, how recently.
Or even as I pointed out, you know, in terms of Childers talking about it's okay for Israel to proactively attack Iran just because. I'm like, how the fuck do they get a free pass to just do this? I thought only America does that.
Yeah. Do you know anything about Childers' background or not?
Not much.
Okay.
But is it me, or did you also perceive that the most recent one was a deviation from his usual?
Well, I haven't read it yet, but have you read it?
First time, what do you think?
Yeah, first time you referenced Israel. I haven't remembered a post that had to do with Israel yet, especially in that context.
Mm. I didn't think he's part of his remit. I thought he was almost entirely COVID-based, wasn't he?
No, it's more from a lawyer angle. Definitely, he's always brought that up.
Okay.
Right, but his whole theme of starting that was to, as a lawyer, gird against the inappropriate legislation and mandates and things and battle back. But why the whole issue of Israel came in made no sense to me. In the context of wars, the same condemnation, again, it's the hypocrisy of the condemnation of Russia and the nuances of what they're doing there in Ukraine. But Israel gets a free pass because they had to, you know, they're the chosens and all that. It was, I've had enough of hypocritical governments justifying slaughter of innocents, and I speak as a disgruntled American who's not apologizing for his own government either. It's enough already.
Yeah.
And Iran has not done anything provable to any other country in my lifetime.
Yes.
Your comment on
Discord that I just responded to this morning. Yeah. I think Iran, has it ever invaded another country?
I think Cyrus was the last one, right? At the 300 and all.
And people who've been there say that it's a beautiful country and the people are wonderful people and not in the least bit warlike.
Right. So I just find it really frustrating that these people who stand up and profess to be the leaders of this resistance against tyranny and oppression and the saviors of human rights, that they all still find reasons to defend these aggressive acts, you know, whether it be funding Ukraine and that little midget green shirted cokehead, or our, you know, weekly bombing of whatever country just pissed us off because it didn't do what we said to do. Anyway,
it does make you wonder, makes me wonder just how many of the people who are touted as sort of, counter narrative, sort of dissident thinkers, how many of them are actually controlled, you know, and have a leash on, you know, have a script that they can't depart from.
How about the backlash that Roger Waters keeps getting when all he does is try to bring up reasonable points about why he's anti-war and he's accused of being a fill in the blank, anti-Semite or fascist or, you know, his most recent stuff with David Gilmour and him got into another tiff because of Gilmour's wife. Are you aware of that?
No, but they always look for excuses to go at each other, don't they?
This time it was Gilmour's wife starting it.
All of his European tour was canceled, right? Because of the Ukraine stuff.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Who, Gilmour's tour or Waters?
Waters. He was going to play in Poland, and then he canceled because of his views on Ukraine.
Yeah.
The Childers stuff, you know, Childers responds to the bar, right? So he's got some organization that he needs to appease to keep his license.
Sure. Yeah. He made a big point. What was the interview I saw with him where he made a big point that he wasn't beholden because he wasn't part of a big corporate, you know, team of lawyers, and therefore he had the independence to speak without any kind of sanction?
Well, he's different in that way. He's a small law firm. You know, you can't do that if you're part of these big 100-plus, you know, associate law firms.
Yeah. But as you say, there is still the bar, isn't there?
If you still want to have your identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
as a lawyer. And, his big pivot was going from, taking on clients more concerned about, dollars and cents and voting rights, corporate stuff, and going into more constitutional law.
Mm-hmm.
So that was his big pivot.
Right.
So, in Perfect Allies, you need people to kind of defend that last shred of paper that we have to keep walls around your house.
Yes. Yeah.
We went to dinner last night with a couple we met through the local rec center. It was kind enough that the wife of the couple invited us. She's in several of our classes we take. It was a very nice dinner, and it was, again, finding more people who share the values, who represent the life and living that we came here for, and discussing it. We were bringing up, and I brought up the Constitution and Bush's famous comment that it's just, mm-hmm. and I found myself impassioned arguing how, it's more than that. It's a set of ideals that we are responsible for continuing to uphold. And it's the culmination of the greatest thinkers of the time reviewing thousands of years of history of government failures and successes and coming up with the best. And we've done better since. And people are throwing it all away because they fail to, live and enforce and expect that people, maintain what's written in that. And I said, here's, and places like this are like the last bastion of the spirit behind that. And if anyone's going to pull this thing around, it's going to be people who live rural and ascribe to the same sort of ideals that are embodied in that. And like, again, I'm going to quote, we talked about this already. John Adams said that this country or any government, republic like this can only survive, with a moral people. That it's not meant for people who are immoral and can't self-govern and control their own passions. And that's what we're seeing, is everyone basically saying they're right, they're going to enforce what they know is right on everyone else, regardless of the facts.
Yeah. Well, the best analogy that you provided recently was the supermarket cart analogy. Mm. That really does exemplify an underlying mentality of complete self-entitlement and indifference, sort of indifference to anything beyond the end of your nose, which I see all the time around me. Mm-hmm. Even the way people drive, what you call roundabouts in America, the
traffic.
You join, merge, and then you take your exit. Mm-hmm. You see, I don't know whether you see it in Britain, it's both courtesy and part of the highway code. If you're coming around a roundabout, you have your indicator going to let people know that you're continuing on, and therefore you shouldn't join at that point. You should wait for a gap. But the numbers of people now I see who are just focused on where they want to go, and they don't bother indicating because they've no reason to, because all they're concerned about is getting their vehicle where they want it to go. And, it's that mentality. It's just those little moments that you see how people are thinking or not thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. Driving in New York, you see every version of it. Here in the States, once you're in the circle or in the roundabout, you have the right of way by default. So you don't need to have your blinker on once you're in there. But I know what you mean. People jumping in and not, and not yielding, but instead just kind of rolling through and expecting you to stop.
Yeah.
But poor driving is another example, like you said, of the shopping cart. I just didn't like there wasn't the third option for the shopping cart, which was to strip the wheels off and the steel and recycle it and use the wheels for a go-kart.
Yeah. That's what you used to do then, Jeff, was it?
Yeah.
You do have the right of way in a rotary, not a roundabout. A rotary is when you continue, like if you're entering the circle, if you're staying in the right and you're going right, you have the right of way because your road kind of continues. Whereas a roundabout is independent. It's fully integrated when you go into a roundabout. Okay. There's a little bit of a difference with yield. So there's a couple in Rhode Island and Massachusetts that are vastly different, and everyone F's it up.
Josh, do you see the same thing even in sort of rural New Hampshire? Are people driving with that kind of fixation on only where they want to go, or is there a sense of more courtesy on the road?
More so here than other places, but still, we have a lot of people from other places.
Yeah.
Specifically Massachusetts.
Right.
I mean, there's one, yeah. You know, a mile from my house that everyone screws up. You know,
right. Okay.
Put a halt yield signs you want. Doesn't matter. You just, they'll stop at a yield sign.
Right. When you say screw up, you mean because they're ignorant or because they're just only absorbed, they're absorbed with themselves?
People don't understand signage.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, there's a clear road that, you know, has no stop sign or yield sign, but because another road crosses it, they just stop every time. And some people get rear-ended for it.
That's the main circle down the road from you, Josh, you're talking about?
Well, there's that one, and then there's the side street going towards the next town where two roads cross and everyone stops. It's just like, man. and it's terrible because it's going downhill, so if there's any snow or ice, people get rear-ended all the time there.
Really? Mm-hmm. Well, now, Nick, you're a professional driver, so I guess all this means a lot more to you, right?
Yeah, I did some of the route yesterday because I had to go and meet the guy that we're going to be transporting is 15, and he's primarily Down syndrome. So we went to meet me and the passenger assistant who lives in the same town as this kid, went to meet him and his foster carer. He's in foster care in a like a private home. Mm-hmm. Lovely, lovely foster mother, really, you know, like the kind of person you would imagine would make a great foster mum. Mm-hmm. And so I did some of that route and got to drive this Kia thing, on a reasonable distance. Very nice car to drive.
Nice.
After my little Skoda. Yeah, do you have Skodas in America?
No.
No? Nah. They used to be a running joke about Skodas in Britain. They were kind of, you know, made by the poorest people in Eastern Europe, you know, they would barely hold together for more than a couple of years before they fell apart.
Are they from Yugoslavia? We had Yugos here. Are they like Yugos?
Similar kind of 80s? Thing, yeah. Yeah, similar sort of thing, yeah. But then Skoda was bought out by Volkswagen.
Okay.
And Volkswagen started putting their motors in and doing all the quality control that Volkswagen does. You
know? Oh, yeah. We call that Chrysler here.
Do you?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
anyway, this is a bit of a diversion. This really, but this Kia, God, it's a lovely car to drive, and so I got to drive on roads that I hadn't driven on for years. Like went past where I last worked about 10 miles up north of here. I drove through the village where I lived in this last job I had. I was working for this multimillionaire guy on his estate. Mm. That was strange, you know. You know when you go through a place that you haven't been through for a while that you used to know pretty well, and it kind of looks familiar and unfamiliar at the same time. You kind of you see little snapshots of your former life, and you think, oh my God, I remember that. Like you look at a gate or a door or something, you think, oh crikey, I remember going through there all the time, you know. And then it's not part of your life anymore, and it's like looking back into a dream almost.
Like visiting an old school or college.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, yeah. So to finish what we're saying there. So yeah, done the route, met the passenger assistant. God, he's an interesting guy. He's what you would call from a fairly low socioeconomic bracket, if I can put it that way. You know, mm-hmm. not stupid. He says he's got a degree in psychology, so he's clearly got a brain. But he's in terms of his sort of social graces, he's a bit kind of. Bit basic, I would say. And he's one of those guys that as soon as he got in the car with me, he had to start telling me about his marital history almost immediately.
Oh, you know? Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's one of those, you know, it's like, yeah, I was married and I got four kids, and he named all his kids, and one of his sons he had to bail out because his son got addicted to gambling, and he had to bail him out to the tune of 20 grand. And at one point he got his son arrested because he felt it was the only way he could deal with him, because there was all sorts of other stuff going on. This was all coming at me in the first like 10 minutes that we were in the car. Oh, I've just let him talk, you know. I said, I've lived a pretty quiet life in comparison with you, I think.
Well, it's good to know he has healthy boundaries.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just fascinating to watch people like that. They've got no sort of filter. check on themselves.
It sounds like the actual work of this job is not the driving or the client you're transporting, but rather, you know, suffering through the daily conversations with your matron here, your chaperone.
Yeah, to be honest, to be fair to him, he's actually got, you know, quite a lot of sort of, you know, a sort of rust. How would you describe it? You know, like there's a charm, you know, he's got a kind of charisma about him, which and he's got a sense of humor, which is what that matters, because if all else fails, you can just find things to laugh at with each other, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, the worst thing is somebody who's kind of po-faced, you know, and never see them crack a smile.
Right. Right. Good. Good.
So, yeah.
So when do you actually start doing the job?
Monday morning. Pay you?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Monday morning.
Welcome back.
Got to some stupid, ungodly hour. Not 5 o'clock. Not as early as that, but probably, I don't know, 6:30, 6:45. I haven't got up at that time for a while.
Do you have a transporter getup? You know, driving shoes, driving gloves, a cap?
Maybe I should, yeah. I'd create my own little uniform.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Dress the part.
The transporter.
Yeah. The worst bit is the town where the kid lives and the passenger assistant is an old, very old English town with very narrow streets. And it's right on the River Severn, and there's one old bridge that goes across the river. I might have mentioned this before. And they live on the PA and the kid live on the wrong side of the river. If they swapped over, it would be easy because I could pick the PA up on the one side, go across the bridge once, pick up the kid, and then drive on to the school. But they live the other way around. So I've got to go to Bewdley, this town, cross the bridge, pick him up, come back across the bridge, pick the kid up, and back across the bridge again to get to the school.
But you're paid by the hour.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't mind. So, not in the least. Yeah. And it's a pretty little town, and the view from the bridge down the river is very nice, and as long as the meter's ticking, I'll be happy.
Right, cha-ching.
Yeah. And of course, one of the great things about the job is that it's school term times only. So I will get all the holidays that schools get in this country, something like 12 or 13 weeks out of the year.
Are they paid or?
Oh, no, no, no.
Oh, no.
No, no. But, you know, this isn't a job that anybody could do as a main income and expect to live. It only works as a supplementary income. Yeah, you just couldn't do it. It's just not enough hours, earning hours. So as a supplementary income, it's fine.
So your middle of the day is wide open then too, which is also what makes it hard for them to find people, because who's going to take a job where you have to be there in the morning, have to be in the afternoon, and therefore it rules out doing anything else during those times. Yeah. And so how many folks have that flexibility to do that job and get by, which you said you can't, so you need a second job, but then second job's going to impinge on the hours they need you for transporting.
Yeah. I mean, it most suits somebody who's retired, got some kind of pension, and just wants something to keep themselves occupied.
Right.
But they're apparently struggling, really struggling to find drivers. You know, they're really, really promoting themselves, you know, in all the channels, you know, on online employment channels, all the rest of it, you know. But they're really struggling to find drivers that will, you know, make the commitment. I think that again is sort of symptomatic or emblematic of the kind of there's a sort of unwillingness to, you know, people that this mentality has developed, I think, and I'm sure it's the same in America, where if you can get something for nothing or work the system, it's better to do that than it is to just do an honest day's work.
Yeah.
You know, even if it isn't that well paid, you know, it's almost been legitimized. You find little ways of exploiting the system and just work on that.
It's a dangerous pattern of behavior if you allow it into your life, the sloth and the laziness and the hand always out instead of taking care of your own business.
Yeah.
Because it bleeds into other areas of your life. And next thing you know, you're lost in the wilderness there.
Yeah. I don't. That's a difficult one, isn't it? Because to some degree or another, at all levels of society, that mentality is pervasive from the top down, isn't it? Tax avoidance by rich corporate, you know, mega corporations, down to the benefit fraud of, you know, Joe Schmo down the street.
Yeah, it kind of comes back a little bit to how we opened, which is talking about a crisis in spirituality has led us to the point where we're at right now.
Yeah.
And some people are blaming, you know, ancient gods. Other people can argue that it's simply a promotion of this selfish me first ideal ahead of charity and a work ethic and you know, an attitude towards self-sufficiency and helping your neighbor and all that.
Yeah. I think it's all connected, obviously. You know, the degree to which we've rejected the divine and the sacred is the degree to which we've embraced this self aggrandizement and it's just filled that void, but there's no moral compass within that. There's no reference point for a basis of morals. It all becomes relativized. So you can say, well, my values aren't your values. Your values might work for you, and I respect that to a point, but my values are the ones I want for me. And so we're all working on that basis, it seems to me. You know, there's no final arbiter of morality, which is what one of the things that religion did pretty well. You could argue it was oppressive to, you know, after a certain point, but in terms of its essential structure, the moral framework that it gave people, I think that was a very important thing that it did for people. And that's gone. And so we're left, as you just said, sort of floundering in the wilderness, trying to construct a system of values that's coherent, but it doesn't incorporate everybody in a meaningful way. I mean, I think this is what E. Michael Jones talks a lot about, isn't it? You know, we've lost that, you know, a benchmark for a set of values that is really durable and which people will abide by because they see there's greater value in subordinating yourself to those values than just promoting your own narrow self-interest and, you know, hope that will get you by.
Well, I know in my life history, I've lived various iterations, some much more in the selfish area. And yet in my older age, I find myself recognizing and realizing and constantly being reaffirmed that there is a proper way to be, that there is a right and wrong, that there is no moral relativism, that in fact, no, some people are just dead wrong and they're trying to rationalize.
Yeah.
And that it's a harder choice at times to do the right thing, but it's worth it in the long run. And as I myself, and then, you know, through my relationship with my wife and with you guys, you know, as this all gets cemented more and validated, and it has over the past few years especially, but it's been an ongoing process. But as it gets particularly rooted and firmed and cemented into my lifestyle, I find that it attracts the same type of people, that it has its own reward. Mm-hmm. In that people seem to pick up on that sort of energy. They some folks can't understand it. Other people are intrigued by it. Other people seek it out. And so, for example, the way we were asked out to this dinner last night with this couple, the guy happens to be a minister. He's not denominational, but and he has that easy storytelling way about him with a good sense of humor. And it was just a surprisingly pleasant interaction where, you know, we're at the point now where, like, oh, we don't want to leave the house anymore. You know, this is going to be so difficult, you know, socializing, you know. And yet we came out of it thrilled because it was just so
that's wonderful.
Yeah, it was excellent. And with promise for the future, but not the pressure of like this weird relationship where sometimes you get that where people are codependent or too needy. It wasn't that at all.
But
I guess my point is that it breeds its own momentum when you start acting and behaving in a way and really holding yourself accountable.
Yes.
And folks, maybe that's what we're talking about a little bit, is also the lack of accountability that is pervasive now, where people aren't accountable for their driving habits. People aren't accountable for their morality. People aren't accountable for their holding their opinions to a logical thesis.
Yes. It's this mentality of, can I get away with it? And the can I get away with it mentality rules completely out of account exactly what you just said about being accountable to yourself first and foremost.
Yeah.
You, of course, can't get away with it because you can't get away from yourself.
Yeah.
But the mentality is, no, actually, as long as I ignore what it's doing to my soul, then of course there's always opportunities to get away with it. Ostensibly, you know, in relation to what other people might see of you, you can hide it, you know, but you can't hide it in the, you can't hide these things from God or right. from your soul. Right. And it's that we've lost, I think. It's that sense of, you know, there is no real hiding place from a lack of a real moral sort of a predisposition towards life. That sounds very, very elevated, a bit lofty, and I hope not too pretentious. I don't mean it to. It's no. difficult to talk about these things without sounding a little bit pretentious, a bit, maybe a bit self-righteous. I don't know.
The times warrant erring on the side of being pretentious if the intention is correct, I think, because we are in deep shit.
Yeah, yeah. But I do feel, and maybe it's, I don't know whether it's more apparent in this country than in your country, but when I'm out and about and I try and, you know, I'm sure we all do the same thing. You know, when you're amongst strangers in the supermarket, that's always my example. Supermarket is, what sort of feeling do I get from the people around me? And, you know, and this could just be my sort of blind optimism, because I daren't admit, you know, the opposite. But I don't think it is. I really do think that there is this sort of impulse in people. They want to find a way of being that feels moral. And they need guidance, you know, and that's what they really want, is the sense that there's a reliable guide that will give them something that they can, you know, hang their hat on. So, yeah, this is the set of values that I really do endorse, you know, and I think it's like people are looking around saying, well, where the hell is it going to come from?
A good shepherd.
Yeah. And because the church has discredited itself in, you know, in large part because of all the scandals that they've been embroiled in. Regardless of denomination, you know, we've got the Archbishop of Canterbury in this country, Justin Welby. You know, he's almost become a joke because he's so signed up to the whole woke agenda that the sort of basic Christian teachings that he should be, you know, the embodiment of that as the head of the Church of England in this country. He's turned it into a kind of just a joke, really. You know, because of some of the ridiculous things he's been saying to try and sound contemporary, you know, up with the times. So if people look at him and think, well, this guy can't be taken seriously, you know, therefore he destroys the credibility of the church.
It is very strange to see the current crop of executive leadership of the various religions all in lockstep in the same ridiculous point of view, and to see former leadership like Vigano, Archbishop Vigano, basically calling them out and calling a spade and saying everything but they're representing the opposite side. You need those alternative voices that have the gravitas that Vigano has, that have the experience and the history to remind you that you're not crazy for thinking, like, am I crazy, when you hear the Archbishop of Canterbury or the current Pope and all that sort of thing, and you're like, how are these men truly, you know, upholding the requirements of their office?
I mean, whenever I listen, I haven't listened to Vigano for a while, but you think, my God, what he really does make you see that the church is capable of being something incredibly important in people's lives, but it's not being allowed to be.
Yes, and he appeals to people whether or not you're religious. That's the beauty of Vigano, is that he just makes sense regardless of if you're a Christian or not, whether you're spiritual, I mean, practicing or not. You are required to have a moral compass to you know, buy into what he's saying. But he calls it out. And there's not enough public voices in opposition to what you're describing. And how all of a sudden it's become a situation where if you speak it in opposition, you are canceled or whatever hell that term. How this has become ubiquitous and something to fear and something to modify your behavior in response to, it's beyond me. I don't understand it.
Question, Jeff. This minister that you just mentioned, who you went to dinner with, did the conversation? It might have been a bit too delicate for a first meeting, but did the conversation ever get anywhere close to his attitude towards the church being open during the last 3 years? You know,
not specific to that, because he described going to Ukraine, he described going to various European churches. I think it's a different sort of ministry through the Southern Baptist Association. It's a loose confederation from what I could pick up. And they actually hold services in people's homes. They do family counseling in their own home, that sort of thing. So I'm not sure it's so much of a brick and mortar operation. And so it tied into that, though, we did discuss the jib jab, and we are, again, part of the counterculture, because it surprised me to learn that even here you had to speak amongst hushed tones, like we're part of some underground that, oh my God, you guys aren't either. Oh, thank God. You know, it was almost like you had to pass the secret code word to get into the clubhouse. And we were both relieved that we all know the same code word, which is go fuck yourself, I think, if I recall correctly.
But just to be clear then, he hasn't been jabbed?
No. And they were thrilled to hear that we also were similar in our attitudes about it. And the amount of damage they were describing in friends and colleagues who have taken it, from Guillain-Barré to seizures and that sort of thing. It was striking to hear.
Really? And he would know a lot of people in the community, wouldn't he, I guess? He and his wife would know very many people.
Yeah.
Very many.
Yeah, very sad. But I thought down here it would be much more like, oh, no, we don't worry about that stuff. No, it was kind of like, oh, you guys aren't either. And it was almost like a conspiratorial tone. It was it was good and bad in the same moment, you know?
Yeah. But did you know before you went there that they hadn't been jabbed?
No, I didn't know.
What might have happened, do you think? Well, things could have taken a very different turn.
Yes.
If you'd been sitting around the dinner table and they'd said, well, yeah, we've had all our jabs and boosters, and anybody who hasn't, we think is pond life.
And, you know, you have to be concerned now with the potential for, is shedding a real thing? Is socializing with people who have this stuff falling off of them, you know, dangerous to your health and to others? I don't know. But as the conversation evolved, and as, you know, the back and forth started to get a little bit more like, oh, yeah, we have a lot more in common than not, it opened up, you know, the ability to bring that whole thing in. But my wife was thrilled to hear when they disclosed that too.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Did they volunteer that, or did it? I mean, how do you remember how it came up in the conversation?
They originally came out with it much more like as a declaration, whereas we sort of danced around it a little bit and we gave every indication that we weren't also, but without saying it. And I felt like as the new guys in town, it was not our role to say, hey, we're here and we're proud that we're not, you know, jib-jabbed. It's like, let's be cool, you know, and just see how this goes. And it worked out perfectly.
I mean, it really is. It's one of those doors, isn't it? That if you know you can go through that same door with other people, open whole frontiers of potential in that relationship that you would never have discovered otherwise. That's the marvelous thing. I think we've talked about this many times before, but this it's almost been a gift to those who can see it that way. What's happened in the last 3 years, you know, this, it's opened things up in a way that would never have happened otherwise.
I don't know about you, Josh, but I take a sort of opposite point of view. I'm sad that this now becomes some sort of dividing line in society where you have to be part of this one third of the population underground. And like I said, have passwords and code words to say, oh, because that also we whispered about, you know, other people who we know of. Oh, this person's the same way. They're like us. I'm like, we're part of this, like, Vichy France here. I mean, we're like the French underground.
Yeah, but that might not last. Did you want to know what does Josh think about that?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Well, you still are preserving a there's less of a chance of other things meddling in that relationship. It's just a bit more pure of a relationship. You know, the part of the jib-jab is inviting something else in. Which I think is what, which I think is like what your natural reaction of that is. It's just fear of like there's something else going on here. So when you can avoid that variable, it's calming and reassuring.
It's like a macro. Once you see that that little command has been, you know, enabled or not followed, then you there's a whole other set of behaviors that you know either did or didn't occur that put you at ease. You're exactly right, Josh. Do you find that up where you're at, where now you're meeting people and that has to be in terms of socializing, not necessarily, you know, your business contacts, but when you to people who you choose to interact with in your free time, do you find that that becomes like a secret whisper at the door sort of thing? We're almost like have our own secret society, if you will, at this point.
Yeah, all of my interactions right now are through people I work with or clients. My socialization is
like the bike, a nosedive. Bike stuff. Yeah, the bike stuff, for example.
I look forward to getting back into that. So, yeah, this summer. Yeah, that hasn't been an issue last summer. Kind of defaulted to everyone is partaked in that.
Most people have.
Yeah.
In the biking community.
Yeah. And the one person that hasn't that I know of, you know, I talked to him quite a bit about it. All throughout 2021 when it was all happening with other people present, and I saw I was just getting no traction on developing that, so it's not worth it.
Were you surprised by that, Josh, by the readiness to comply?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, and even after, I feel like I got ahead of it with some people too, and they still ended up doing it. even with resources to look at.
Yeah.
But everyone was pressured for one reason or another. You know, how I want to visit my grandma. Or something. I want to visit my mom, and I want to go on a vacation. I mean, the excuses people were pulling on this stuff was just absurd.
Listen, are you forgetting the beer and the cheeseburger? They're offering a free beer and a cheeseburger.
Not around me.
Oh, down here in New York, yeah.
I think I got an ice cream or something, or a donut.
A Cuomo donut.
Wasn't worth it.
That's one of the things that mystified me the most was how people didn't seem to regard the barrier, the boundary of their own skin. They didn't seem to regard that as something that should be inviolable, you know, unless you give permission, you know, the idea of, I mean, how do I put it?
I know what you're saying. I think I think the fact tattoo culture was introduced over the last 25 years, inured people to accepting needles much more so than they would in the past.
That is a really interesting point.
Because now it's rare to not have a tattoo. It used to be the opposite.
That's an interesting point. That is really. I wonder if that was maybe a meme that was cultivated deliberately to, you know, get people acclimatized to the idea of invasion.
That's my premise. Yeah.
That is a really interesting point.
On the flip side, everyone just trusts. Yeah, they all have blind trust.
Well, they want to trust.
They do. It's not about want. Excuse me. I'm sure that's a degree, but you know, just they wake up in the morning and they understand that there's people that are out there, you know, making sure that they're protected. You know, the medical community is out to help you.
But you know, your guys in your biking community, they're smart people. They look beyond the headlines, don't they?
There's a few.
You'd think they'd be aware of the problems that they've been with vaccines in the past and how they've had to be pulled after, you know, just a small number of adverse reactions or, you know, a couple of deaths. And
yeah, those have always been very easily explained away. Susan Humphrey's book has been out there for, I don't know, over 10 years.
Yeah.
15 years, maybe.
Yeah. And there's another one now, isn't there? The Steve Kirsch. Is it Steve Kirsch? Or it was... I don't think it was written by him, but it was it you or Jeff that put it up on Discord recently? Another book exploding the myths of vaccines, much more recent.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought Kennedy had one, but
it's called Turtles All the Way Down. It's been somebody one of us posted it. It must have been Jeff then.
Yeah, it must have been. I didn't think that had to do with vaccines in general.
I think it was certainly connected with the COVID vax, but. But I think that, you know, the wider implications are that it's all founded upon a myth.
I have to see if he remembers that.
This idea of trust intrigues me because people generally speaking, certainly in this country, people have a certain level of education. Well, maybe not even a certain level of education, actually. But generally speaking, there is a distrust towards politicians, government, big government. You know, there's just a natural kind of wariness that they're out to screw us over in one way or another. And yet the same people who profess to be cynical about government have been the same people who've done a complete about face and trusted what these same politicians were telling them right at the start,
there has to be balance, you know, to have someone that pitted against a group of people, all that emotion, all that trust has to be, you know, put in something. So if you're if there's a better word for it, but if you're vilified, or if you're angry, or you're scared about something, you know, your solace and your trust has to be in something else. So people have always offset their unease with politicians, with their appreciation for what a selfless group like doctors can do for them.
I grant you that. But, you know, but it was politicians who were promoting, you know, what we saw every day in Britain on the news was the health secretary, the prime minister, you know, the people, the senior people in government telling us what was actually happening, you know, explaining why social distancing was necessary and all that garbage. And the people who you would expect to be most cynical, least taken in by that kind of PR, turned out to be the ones who bought into it the most readily.
Well, yeah, because the politicians aligned themselves with the medical community.
Trust, even that trust the science mantra.
Well, if you had, you know, someone who appreciates their local doctor, right? And you're a politician who doesn't have your people's trust, then using the local doctor as your PR campaign is a great way for you to tie your train to that engine.
You know? Yeah.
A great way for politicians to get trust is to align themselves with a trustworthy group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or to, you know, take control of it, which is accurate. Hey, Dad, did you have you mentioned a book on Discord about turtles and all the way down kind of type of thing? Is that a vaccine book that you referenced recently?
It's actually a while ago. I put something more recent, but yeah, it was recommended as like an adjunct to the Humphreys book as well.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's Turtles All the Way Down. That looks like a novel. But
No.
That's something to do with turtles.
No, there's a non-fiction. They said, I remember reading on Steve Kirsch's. Yeah,
Turtles All the Way Down is what it's called.
He said, yeah. Don't confuse it with the novel.
Vaccine science. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Don't confuse it with the Indian Vedic religion, right?
Yeah.
well, that.
Have you got a synopsis of it?
There's also
a novel too.
Okay. Well, Steve Kirsch was one who referred to it back. Yeah. I came upon it in December. And it's basically the same thing that Humphreys argues in Dissolving Illusions, which is that vaccine efficacy has been inappropriately associated and correlated with better health outcomes, when in fact sanitation and hygiene are far more important in terms of influencing that, and that the data was fudged and manipulated to suggest that since introduction. But when you actually get granular with it, what you see is a steep decline in incident rate prior to introduction of vaccines in every case.
So this book is just a more recent, updated example of the same phenomenon.
I never bought it. I never, because I said I have to start reading more books than buying books, because I don't even, they're still in boxes here, so I can't buy any more books until I get them out of boxes and I start reading more and get through my queue. But yeah, that's my understanding from Kirsch as to what the premise is. And again, like I said, you know, Humphreys made the argument, and how many more times do you have to read the same argument to recognize and understand that Rockefeller and company purposefully created the industry and whoever was behind him to get us to this point right now, to get us away from trusting our bodies, to get us away from understanding how it's very simple to live a healthy lifestyle if you choose to. Clean water, good hygiene, exercise, and clean food is all you need. Mm-hmm. And they don't want you to know that, because you can't make money off of that, and you can't control people if that's all they have to do, because it's too easy for them to thrive independently if they recognize it's all they have to do.
Yeah.
So the model now is I have a potion or elixir for everything that ails you. Come on here. And also I'll tell you the wrong things to eat and drink and minimize the important stuff so that you are deficient in nutrients. And I'll also introduce all these other chemicals that bleach out of you everything that's good and healthy. Yeah. Once you see the con, it's very simple.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very easy to understand. And again, I go back to people, if you can just convince them to, as a thought exercise, consider for a moment that the controlling forces, whether they be government, religious leaders, any leadership, consider for a moment that actually their intentions are malevolent. And then all of a sudden, all the actions make sense. It's only when you think that they're all benevolent that you're like cognitive dissonance, because you're like, well, how can it be? It's impossible because they're good and they care. That's the gimmick. Now, you know what? Now assume they're evil, and it all fucking makes sense.
Yeah. Jeff, the news, the only news bulletin that I watch that's worth watching in this country, well, one of the very few, is a UK column. Yes. And one of the chief anchors on that, Brian Gerrish, his name is, he said exactly what you said, and he says it fairly often. He's just trying to reframe or encourage people to reframe their entire perspective.
Yeah.
Once you've recontextualized it, as you just said, it's very easy to see why things are playing out the way they are. But people don't want to believe it because that level of duplicity and malevolence is it kind of fries the brain, I think, for a lot of people. You know, so they continue to kind of kid themselves on that actually, you know, there must be good people somewhere who are doing something, you know, they're doing the right things for us.
I know I reference Alan Watt all too often, but there's so much to what he said and how much it influenced me in the way I see things now. But he was describing in a talk to someone who had been, he'd called into the radio show, and his talks from 1998 are the only thing he sold pretty much. He addressed this very same point. And what he said was that most people just seek out security. They seek out comfort, like in a blanket. And they don't want to give up the security of that blanket. And it's that simple. It's just, and who doesn't like to cozy up with a nice warm blanket? But to get people to face the harsh reality, you know, without that sort of comfort about them is a very difficult thing. And few people are able to do it. And he argued also that it's always been this way, and that it's always been only a small percentage of people who are willing and able to emerge from that sort of cocoon, that security, if you will, and to face things as they are.
That is
the lament, and that is the condition that we always seem to face, and every new generation does.
I think that's something that perpetually astounds me, is that inability, unwillingness, as you say, to confront the raw, unvarnished truth of the situation and take that as your starting point. If you can never get to that as a starting point, then what hope do you have of making anything better? Because whatever you prescribe is going to be based on false premises.
Well, and also once it takes root, once the lifestyle or the expectation of comfort, security, and unconditional reward without any sort of effort, once that takes root and parents then pass those values on to their children, it's very hard to then break out of it, because all you know is everything that's been handed down to you, and we're imitative, you know, and we follow the lead of our families and our parents. So how do you break away? And again, I think that my personal cross to bear is also my biggest gift, which is my unique situation. Well, it's not unique, but relatively speaking, a fairly unique sort of upbringing created in me a constant cynicism and a constant questioning of authority that has never been more important to have as a point of, you know, way of thinking than it is now. But most people don't have that. Most people just are following the lead that was given to them. And if they were born into relatively comfortable circumstances, they have no reason to suspect that the world is out to get them now.
Yes. Yeah.
I've always thought the world was out to get me. So that's where I, you know, went through various rebellious behavior patterns and finally landed here. And it turns out this was the best thing that could happen to me to survive this current onslaught.
Yeah.
But that seems to be all this has happened before and all this will happen again, right, Josh?
Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun.
I was quoting Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, right.
Tell you, Nick, it's a great show. You should watch it.
You know, I tried.
Get past the first episode and get a few episodes in and then tell me you can't stop watching it.
Okay.
The miniseries is a little long at times, yeah.
Mm-hmm. A maxi miniseries.
Oh, so, yeah, it was the premiere, right? Was it like 3 hours, 4 hours?
Oh, yeah.
But once you get like to the first several episodes, then you can't stop watching it.
Mm-hmm. Talking of things such as films, what have you? Have you seen anything recently that you think was worthwhile?
I saw on Amazon Prime with that guy from The Office, The American Office, BJ, what's his name, the little guy. He did a thing called Vengeance, which was a New York guy who goes to Texas. It was an interesting sort of contrast of societies, especially since I'm New York and I've gone to here. It's not dissimilar. And he stole the comment that I first voiced here amongst you folks, and you guys are evidence of this. He went down there and basically the line came out in the midst of this where he says, bless your heart means go fuck yourself. And I, you could have knocked me over the feather. I'm like, he stole my joke. And I turned to my wife. I was like, see, I told you. And then I was just thinking about Jan saying, and God bless your hearts when we closed that. That cracked me up.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was a decent little thing. It was showing how the attitudes of a modern New York urban dweller are so ridiculous when you bring those sort of values into like a rural society and you know, the arrogance that the big city attitude can have towards country folks and all that. But it was relatively pleasant. And lately most things annoy me, so that's actually a big endorsement for me. It's hard to watch film though. Sorry. Yeah.
Do you and your wife make a point of sitting down and trying to find something that you can watch from, you know, a recent movie or something from Netflix?
I no longer try because I'm anti TV so much now. There's only a few things I'll watch. We'll watch some cooking shows. Like I don't know if he's popular over there, but Robert Irvine's like a celebrity chef, and he has a show over here. He's from either Australia or Britain. I forget which.
Okay, I don't know the name.
Yeah, he's been in America for a long time, but he was in, I think, British military for a while. They know how to cook. But anyway, he has a show where he comes to different restaurants that are failing throughout America and he turns them around, and it's a formulaic thing. But it's fun to watch. Huh?
Is like Gordon Ramsay. You know Gordon Ramsay?
Not quite as abrasive, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean that just became very tiresome after a while watching Ramsay tear strips off inept restaurant owners.
It was cruel. It was cruel at times. That's what I didn't like about it.
He
has a little bit more of a tough love kind of approach, and he's like a former bodybuilder and he still is like, you know, beefy guy, so he comes in with his tight t-shirt and his giant biceps and all this and that. But then he turns the restaurant around and everyone's hugging and crying and it's all just like a wonder. It's always a happy ending. And then we just watched to see the end to see, okay, after he left, how did the restaurant do? Because there's plenty of times where my wife would Google it afterwards to find out, oh, they closed 6 months later.
Yeah, that doesn't make such good TV, though.
But aside from that, I'm just disgusted with the state of what they put out there for movies and television. There's nothing I'm interested in.
Yeah. No, I kind of agree.
But you, Josh, you watching anything?
Not that I can recall, no.
You're even more virulently anti-TV than Jeff, if that's possible, aren't you?
Well, I don't turn it on. I don't seek anything out. But if someone says, "Oh, you should watch this," I'll add it to the list. I looked up Beef for Vengeance with Novak in it, but I wasn't interested.
Yeah.
But always look at him, though.
Yeah, no, it was interesting for me just as a clash of cultures. That's why that's the part I looked at it.
Yeah. And you kind of live in that life, you know, the New York going to the rural Alaska. Yeah, so I could see that being something that you're like, oh, I wonder what other people are saying about this kind of interaction.
How about you, Nick? Are you recommending anything?
For some reason, I've never enjoyed watching series of any type. You know, anything that runs, you know, one week to the next and you're supposed to follow a developing storyline, I get bored. I don't know. I think I've said this before. I like movies where, you know, you watch for 2 hours and it's all tied up and done in a couple of hours.
Sure.
What was the most, trying to think what I've seen recently. God, my brain goes blank. I watched a Japanese anime with my daughter last week, which was distracting, but, you know, fairly superficial.
My wife and I were saying the state of movies now is ridiculous. Aside from superhero movies, there's simply nothing interesting or unique or intriguing. It's like they've run out of ideas and they just keep repackaging superhero movies.
Yeah.
You know, we remember a time when something would come out and it was completely unexpected. I remember growing up and you remember the movie The Sting with Robert Redford and Paul Newman?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I saw that in the theater. Yeah. I mean, I saw Raiders of the Lost Ark in the theater. These were accidental, like walking in saying, oh, what's this movie? Okay, let's just go check it out and see. And now, if something so unique and well-written were to come out, it would just blow everyone's mind. But back then, it was almost like incidental. Yeah. It was like, oh, yeah, another great movie came out, you know.
Yeah. Did you remember I mentioned a film I saw at the cinema a few months ago called The Banshees of Inisherin? I really would recommend that as a really good example of what you're talking about, Jeff. A movie that seems to come out of nowhere and just tap into something that you just don't expect to see being, you know, developed. A beautifully made film, fantastic performances, and just really interesting themes.
I would Banshees thoroughly, of what?
The Banshees of Inisherin. Inisherin is this fictional island where all the drama takes place. It's set during the days of the Irish Civil War, back in the early 20th century.
Okay.
And what happens between the two central characters is a kind of sort of a microcosm of what's going on at the macro level and the political level with the divisions in Ireland itself. It's beautifully done. It really is. I defy you not to enjoy it because there's just so much charm in it and originality.
It must have Colin Farrell in it.
Yeah, it does.
The last one you recommended, I think I've seen two movies, I think. Maybe three this year. Yeah, three. So Angel Heart. Life, what's that movie everyone watches on New Year's? Or at least we did.
Wonderful Life.
Wonderful Life. I sat down and actually watched that. It's the first time ever. Angel Heart, and then one a couple weeks ago, Ghost Rider, which I really enjoyed. McGregor? Ewan McGregor. Oh, right. No, not Rider. Not the motorcycle flaming skull thing. The Ghost Rider. Was it you? I guess it wasn't you that recommended it. That was probably Jan then. The Ghost Rider. I would recommend it. I think it was really very well done.
That's Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I was surprised with how very blatant that they put it out there that, you know, how obviously controlled governments and these global politicians are by the CIA.
Hmm.
I mean, it was very much on the forefront of the plot of the movie.
Wow.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna see if I can find it on.
It was pretty much just as obvious as Battlestar was of the Iraq War. That movie came out in 2010 and it was very obviously. I mean, the name of the company was basically Halliburton, paying for the private jet of like a Tony Blair kind of character that is still relevant after he leaves office.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and still matters in the court of public opinion. Hmm. And CIA handlers, and who was the handler, when they got taken in by the agency, and who the real controlling people are in the movie aren't revealed until the end. So it's very good.
So how many Academy Awards did it win, do you think?
Oh, zero. And Pierce Brosnan can't even say he was in the movie. Yeah.
And look, I've got it up on the screen here. See who the director is. Most unexpected.
Polanski, right?
Polanski.
Which is, telling, because isn't he like wanted by the FBI? He can't come to this country. I don't get how he films movies in Massachusetts if he's not allowed in this country. If he's gonna get arrested for the kid thing.
He has to bring his own little girls. He can't get any from here.
Jesus. Who knows what's the real story there?
Yeah, it is funny how when you cross the powers that be, all of a sudden kiddie porn shows up on your computer.
Open and shut case, Johnson. Sprinkle a little kiddie porn on him.
How about the latest Arkanside with that guy who tied himself to a tree with electrical wire and then shot himself twice in the chest?
One. There were so many this week.
Yeah.
So, I mean, well, that happened, a year ago,
right.
Which they just finally unsealed the.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I guess we do have to explain, how he died. Shot himself in the chest with a shot. They leave it to indicate there was a shotgun, which is because they found shotgun shells.
Right.
But, no gun. Near his body and wrapped.
Well, he wrapped himself around a tree, shot himself, then he tossed the gun far enough away so that he could.
I said he had a really good arm. Yeah. He had a really, or those birds, they love shiny objects. Carry it away.
Well, yeah. That's how they disperse seeds across the country. They eat them and then they shit them out. I guess they could have eaten the shotgun and shit it out somewhere else.
People in England will think that's true because of how pervasive guns are in America, right? Oh, even the birds have them.
No, you can't walk 5 feet in the park without coming across a discarded gun, Josh. You know that.
What was the story or the suggested story behind that then? Was it the Clintons implicated in it?
He was Clinton's chief of staff. Mark.
Oh, right. Okay.
He had all the secrets.
Yeah. Right. But he was only done away with last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he's whatever. Not playing by the script anymore.
Maybe he started having some pangs of conscience.
Or they needed a fall guy.
What was the evidence that he was about to start talking?
It's the fallout from the Epstein stuff.
Okay. Right.
And the other really interesting one from Arkansas was the plane that took off heading to Ohio. Crashed immediately.
The five environmentalists.
Five environmentalists.
Yeah. What just happened?
Yeah, five people going to Ohio to do testing. Supposedly more connected to the forge, the metal forgery that went up in smoke. But there's conflicting reports. Some people actually say that the company they work for was hired by North Fork Southern to do testing.
Right. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah. But the plane, and so they blame it on the pilot. They said poor decision on the pilot to try to beat the thunderstorm.
Poor decision not driving yourself instead of saying, you know what, small planes are dangerous to your health in your controversial role or figure.
Seriously.
Yeah.
How many more do you need to realize? Maybe I shouldn't be taking small charter flights.
I guess when Nick gets back, I do want to discuss the whole theory that was put on Rents, because Joseph Farrell actually referenced Rents, and he said it qualified. He says, I normally don't reference this guy as a source, but he believes his legs to it. We're talking to Nick about the latest theory that Josh and I were briefly talking about, which is some sort of insider supposedly saying that the East Palestine, how do they pronounce it, Josh? East Palestine, not Stein?
Yeah,
East Palestine. Palestine.
East Palestine.
Something different. But the chemicals weren't vinyl chloride, but in fact were similar but different. But they were the precursors to phosgene, to mustard gas, and that the intention was to transport them as the precursor chemicals to Europe and then get them to Ukraine and then create a false flag and blame it on Russia that they used a gas attack to then justify escalation of the war. And the evidence that the person cites is EPA's own admission that phosgene gas was one of the byproducts of the controlled burn. It's like I was saying to Josh, what I can't understand is you can't have it both ways. You can't have it where this was a recent operation that was sabotaged in order to, you know, prevent World War III from starting, while also having it filmed last year as a way to the revelation of the method stuff that you know has become pretty well known now. So you can't have it where it was intentionally done and then we gave everyone their my IDs to track their health status, see how they respond to being chemically poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
And also, oh, this was also a secret military operation to create a false flag. You can't have both at the same time.
Well, maybe it wasn't for Ukraine then. You know, maybe all that could still be true if it wasn't for Ukraine.
But everything's all Ukraine all the time now. That's where, you know, that's all the effort and action and money is. It's like someone says, why don't we just give Zelensky our ACH number for our bank account so that he doesn't have to keep asking. He can just go take withdrawals whenever he needs them.
Can I just check that I'm not being stupid here? The fact that this movie White Noise was made in the same town with people who subsequently suffered in the real thing, that in itself points, doesn't it, to the fact that it was a deliberate something was done. This was not an act. It was done deliberately by somebody for some reason.
There's a bit of a Wicker Man aspect to it too. That I was thinking about how in the Masonic tradition, basically, the Wicker Man is given all the clues if they are smart to know that their demise is imminent unless they get out of there. And so when they're finally burned inside the structure, it's their own fault because they failed to see what was apparent to them. And in this case, you know, they could argue, hey, we told you what was going to happen and we even paid you and you took the money and we said we're going to poison your town and you didn't get out when you had plenty of time to. And that's how they think. It's fucks.
Yeah. And this is, again, the reason why I think these booked movie people are, you know, if they're not completely manufactured, there's some level of compliance because that was done.
A Newtown thing you're kind of arguing, Josh?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, definitely with that.
I mean, the Stanley Hook thing.
Yeah.
You mean,
yeah, there's evidence that Newtown is a completely manufactured town and that real estate transactions were done as a money laundering operation.
But also White Noise, you know, the Don DeLillo book is, you know, kind of the same kind of story of Tevis and his stuff being used for different purposes, you know, drugs and alcohol or whatever. Because, you know, that was also made into a movie, The Man That Fell From Whatever and Done a Queen's Gambit. I think
in Color of Money, right?
Yeah, I didn't realize he wrote.
Everything he's written has turned into a movie.
I'd be really, really suspicious about those kind of actors.
Who was so successful?
He was a Bay Area guy, and he died in 1984. And anyone who dies in 1984, something about 1984, he stuck out too. He's pretty young.
He was only 56.
Yeah.
So are you suggesting then that, you know, I asked you about, you know, what you were suspicious of. You think that Tevis himself might have been operating as, you know.
Or he's just a front. And, you know, maybe he's just given stuff. He was just like, you know, like Ghost Rider, right? He's just given the script and, all right, you just finish it up.
Lifetime.
Really? So you don't think that he originated his ideas entirely himself?
No. I don't think so.
It's another piece of evidence saying that no one is that successful without having a team behind them and being authorized to be the author.
Right. Yeah. Books translated in 18 languages. The guy's, you know, he's got some serious backing.
Four books, four hit movies. It doesn't happen.
Or a TV show. Real life.
All right. But what I want to say is, having finished it yesterday, the novel, regardless of what might be happening behind the scenes, he is a good writer.
It had an F. Scott Fitzgerald kind of tone to it, reading it a little bit. Steinbeck kind of tone.
Yeah, I agree, and that's the kind of writing I like best. I really like American writers because they're not constrained in the same way that British writers are.
Well, they're not going to hire an incompetent person, right? If they have a project,
only the best teams, only the best writing teams here in America.
Sure. But, you know, I'm saying is that you can. you can appreciate it as a piece of art, irrespective of whatever its propaganda purpose might be.
I've had this conversation before in other circles,
allow it. You're too puritanical.
No, just you can't ignore one thing in spite of another. You know, you and just be honest with yourself. Like, yeah, I enjoy the writing, but I still know that he's probably, you know, there's a poison in this message that you need to always be aware of and don't disregard it.
It's like, I enjoy the New York Giants as a football team, but I know the NFL is satanic and that the Super Bowl show is a ritual and that all the games are fixed.
I just refuse to believe, okay? This is my ideological prejudice, if you like. I'm not going to believe that I've been suckered into, you know, seeing something or not seeing something that I should be seeing.
It is understandable that you're going to hold on to a few things that still keep your innocent outlook on the world, you know, pure. You have to have a few places where you still think that the world is like it was before you get woken up to all the craziness.
I want to believe that great art, and I'm not saying The Man Who Fell to Earth is great art. I'm saying it's a very well-written novel. But I want to believe that great art transcends politics, all things. It comes from somewhere, it comes from another place, and it's a place which is not governed by rules.
It's the rat poison analogy again. Once again, in order for them to conduct any kind of cultural or social engineering, it has to be mostly truth with the poison mixed in, like rat poison. It's 90% good quality stuff, otherwise you wouldn't be interested in it, but then you have to watch out for the 10%. So as you're reading that book, what tropes or what sort of things are being injected in there that are meant to nudge you along in the direction that ultimately they're trying to get everyone to go towards? I mean, that's you know, it's how I watch TV now, it's how I read books now, it's how I think what Josh is alluding to also, which is it's fine to enjoy it, but just don't delude yourself into thinking that there's pure innocence to it and this is actually really organic. Assume by default that it's astroturf, not real grass. Assume by default that there's some poison bitten here that I have to be on the lookout for. That's assume that this is not one person writing this, but rather a team behind. You know, this person is the front man or woman. That's the premise that, you know, we're unfortunately forced to remind ourselves about.
But I can't come to it. I can't come to it with that at the forefront of my mind, because it would just. I remember we talked about this before. It would just destroy, like you just said, Jeff. You know, if you're seeing everything through that filter in the first place, then any genuine artistic value that there might be in it is going to be so massively compromised that it might as well not be there, because it's just going to seem like artifice, a contrivance for ulterior reasons that you don't like. You know, I want to enjoy reading things. You know, with that open kind of receptive mind, you know, that just
understood. But just if you're reading someone,
before you interrogate it.
If you're reading someone who's got four best-selling novels that have all been turned into movies, assume though that this is not an independent author who just happens to just, gosh darn it, be so darn good and lucky. That's all.
Is it not possible that he just happened to have that ability to, you know, tap
just,
into?
Yes, just like Shakespeare. Absolutely. You know, the guy who couldn't read, but he wrote all those great books.
Yeah.
He wrote all those great plays.
But what about, I mean, let's say, what about music then? I mean, music's a different.
Queen's Gambit won 11 Emmy Awards.
Okay.
And The Hustler.
Paul
Newman liked them.
Take music. Oh, scared him off, look. I mean, I think music is something that is less likely to be subject to those kinds of, you know, controls and influences.
Equally so.
I'm thinking of orchestral music, you know, instrumental music.
That's
I think
true.
It's difficult.
Absolutely not true.
Well, I know somebody
Michael Jones has talked about this too, with how they changed the scale. I'm speaking out of my league here, but yeah, how they changed the scale and sound and tempo. They played with it in different ways to weaponize it. You know, modern orchestral music is satanic compared to where it was even in the Baroque era.
Well, there is some pretty dreadful music that passes through. Yeah, I agree. But I mean, you know, you take a Beethoven symphony, or you know, how can that be? It is what it is. You know, I forget who it was now, but somebody said famously that all art is propaganda. And in a very sort of most general sense, yes, of course it is, because anybody who sits down to compose anything in any medium is trying to say something and promote a particular point of view. So, of course, it's propagandistic in that respect. But I would argue that it doesn't necessarily devalue it. It doesn't necessarily infer something nefarious or underhand. You know, it's just the nature of the artistic endeavor that, you know, that you're going to be influenced by it in some way or another. And some influences are benign or even more than benign, you know, positively benevolent, and others won't be, and still more will just be more or less neutral because they don't have the capacity to do anything very important. So we're just talking about the nature of the artistic endeavor itself, Jeff, and the fact that it serves propagandistic purposes, whatever medium you operate in, however you choose to express yourself, you are seeking to convey a message of some kind.
Orwell sort of saying that all art is propaganda.
Yeah, they just used that very quote. Was it Orwell who said that? Okay. But my argument is that even though that is almost by definition true, it doesn't necessarily mean that all artistic expression has been co-opted and, you know, funneled down a particular avenue to serve an agenda. It just wouldn't be any point. It wouldn't be possible because there's more output that could possibly be controlled in that way.
Very much so. Beethoven was controlled, right? With your example,
who Beethoven was controlled.
Sure.
Who by?
How do you know who Beethoven is? How do you know who Mozart is? You know, the sound at the time.
I have no idea.
Right? The creation of the Romantic era had a purpose. and that purpose was different from the Baroque era. Right?
Josh Doonan, the abattoir of sacred cows.
Yeah, but it this goes back to Plato in the Republic arguing how music has to be controlled because it has such influence and sway over the population, and that
in this backdrop, like when I'm comparing the Baroque to the Romantic era, they specifically had different sounds for a reason, right? They're driving a different global consciousness, and that's how they did it back then.
But were they doing it deliberately and consciously themselves, or were they just, you know?
You can't leave that to chance. You got a world to run. Come on, man. The sun shall never set on the British Roman Empire, and you got this lead up to 1800. You need nationalism, right? So you're gonna have a lot more nationalistic tones to your music with Beethoven than you ever did, even with Mozart or Bach before that. Mozart being another Romantic era, though.
Okay. Yeah, I see your point. I see your point. Yeah,
that's a fair one. It changed the frequency, changed the tone. The arrangements, everything is vastly different.
Yeah, the empire never ended. It just kept changing and adapting to the great work and the evolution towards that.
Right. Yeah, national identity. That's what I'm going for.
Okay.
And now they're ending that.
The Diurnal versus the Nocturnal. Right. I feel like there's a lot of different traits you can go into with those different music and the purpose of those traits.
Right. And now what we have is a coarse sort of music that has taken over with a lack of...
We have fractured music now.
Right.
Completely compartmentalized and fractured.
But it's also
you can't hold a tune. You can't hold a thought. Right.
And, well, you auto-tune it.
The way they chop it in editing, is, I think, very, very MK Ultra-esque.
Yeah.
We're doing this. Now we're doing something completely different. Now we're going to flash to this and flash to that.
Yeah.
And the spiritual entity part of it now is just very on point in front of everyone. You can't avoid it. How there's there's many other things in the room beside you and the artist. And, you know, right. Whether you go with the like, Jimmy Page writings with how that was like purposely something that you would develop and create, or now with, you know, you just have handlers that kind of do all the homework for you and set you on your way to becoming someone who just, as Katy Perry says, sign your soul over to the devil.
While we're on the subject, while we're on the theme, and I know we've talked about it before, can I just want to get hear you say your thoughts again, both of you, about the Beatles. Are you both convinced that the Beatles didn't write their own songs, that they were all written for them?
Yeah.
Yes.
Quite sure.
Yeah.
And do you think it was this Adorno character, this Theodore Adorno, or was it a team of writers, or what? Or doesn't that really matter?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah. I've heard Adorno. I don't have any evidence other than the word of someone who, you know, has been right more than they've been wrong. He had the musical chops. He was the Queen's musical advisor, right, apparently, or whatever.
I know that.
Yeah, apparently he had access to Queen Elizabeth quite often and was musically like the key guy for the court. Yeah. I think John Coleman is the one who first put that out there in writing.
Who?
John Coleman. He was a supposed English intelligence agent who defected and wrote all those secrets out about stuff
wrote the Committee of 300, didn't he?
Yes. I believe it's in that the Adorno.
Yes, I think you're right.
Thing specified.
Yeah, but others have talked about it. Yeah. Okay. I wasn't going to take that anywhere. I was curious to hear you say it again. I personally think it's possible that, I mean, if you think about it, okay, if Adorno was such an amazing writer of catchy pop tunes, why the hell didn't he produce and sell them, you know, market them under his own name and become ultra rich?
Who says he wasn't ultra rich to begin with?
Well, that's true. I mean, I know nothing about the bloke.
Yeah, he already had access to the Queen. So, I mean, how much more dough does he need? I think that, again, the people we see who are put in front of us as the supposed, people who run and drive society, if we know their names, they're really just the middle management. It's the ones who we don't know. Like that thing I posted that showed all the obscure royalty all over the place, all over the world, worth billions and billions of dollars. Those are the people who much more so have connections to really the levers of power. People we see, they're meant to take the slings and arrows and also get the rewards to implement what's going on. But they aren't the ones who decide the agenda, create the agenda, or support intellectually or creatively the agenda. They're just the public faces of it, because you need to have a public facing, you need to have a front of the house, and then there's a back of the house. And the cooking and stuff that goes on, we don't know who's back there as the chef.
So if the Beatles were entirely fabricated, that doesn't that then suggest that the Rolling Stones must have been as well, then, as the sort of the counterpoint to the Beatles, you know, to create that dialectic, you know, the dark and the light.
Yeah. And you know, people argue that sometimes, like with Ron Wood, I guess, or Mick Taylor, the original guitarist of the Stones, getting whacked. These are people who wouldn't play ball with the script. These are people who really did probably have some creative juices and wanted to write their own stuff, and were told, "Oh no, we're going to give you everything. You just play it, and you're set for life." And if they bristled at that, then well, guess what? You're going to be Stu Sutcliffe.
Yeah.
It's hard when you know your heroes, if you will, are found to be not only mortal but actually amorally mortal and just stooges. But, you know, McCartney, how long has it been since he actually did anything of relevance? Once he was actually let loose on his own, the stuff he puts out is atrocious. I mean, come on.
Pretty bland stuff, yeah.
Oh, disgusting. It's like worse than nursery rhymes, the stuff he puts out.
The Frog Chorus isn't an immortal piece of songwriting. Come on.
I mean, I think Wings was like that. He had a few gifts that were leftover Beatles songs that they gave him to like Band on the Run and that kind of stuff. But most of that stuff was just horrific. And you hear Linda McCartney, when they don't have her when they were isolated off of the mixing board. Oh my God, she's worse than Yoko. Yeah.
But she could shake a tambourine.
Oh God, that's what I'm saying. These bands are propped up by external forces and suppliers that they can never thrive on their own. I'm not saying that there aren't amazing musicians out there, but there's plenty of amazing musicians who never get any success because they just don't have the backing. That's what Josh's premise is.
Right. Yeah, they're on the streets of Louisiana.
Yeah.
But what I would find plausible is that the Beatles came into existence organically in the first case. Okay.
No.
They went. Hang on. Don't jump on me, John. They went to Hamburg. That all happened organically, and then certain place people. I can't even take myself seriously now. We're looking for something that they could get their teeth into. They needed the raw material to mold, and the Beatles were the perfect raw material because they were a tight outfit. They had an identity that could be very persuasively marketed. You know, the four lads from Liverpool. You know, all that, with the mop tops and all the rest of it. They were the perfect blueprint for then doing your own culture creation through. Is that plausible?
The big reveal is, I think, was it McCartney or was it Lennon who at the end of one of those Beatles songs says, "Thank you all, and I think we passed the audition."
Right.
That's how they get created. They are all brought in and they're interviewed and they audition for people who are actually controlling the record companies, and they in turn are controlled by the big shots. And so that group was the ones who were selected amongst many other young English lads, if you will, but not because of their musical talent. Nick, when I was in undergrad 40 years ago now, I met this guy, and Pink Floyd's album, The Final Cut, had just come out. And within like a couple of weeks of that album coming out, I sat with this guy, and he was a guitarist, and he played like two or three songs note for note, nailing Gilmore and everything perfectly. And I was just like enraptured, you know, because I've always been a big Pink Floyd fan. But my point is, high level musicianship is very common, actually. When you look, people, there's plenty of people who can just hear and imitate the music. They can compose their own stuff. They know chords. They just hear it. And there's tons of people with that level of skill. Now, if you don't have it, it seems like it's so rare and it's so amazing and almost so special. But what I found is that even, you know, someone like Springsteen, a very average musician at best, he could play harmonica. His voice is, yeah, you have to learn to like it. It is an intrinsically beautiful voice. So all these bands are actually very middle of the road in terms of the level of skill that is out there and just everywhere, you know, if you just happen to come across it. So to say like, no, they were specially talented, they weren't. They had to have been given the opportunities they got because, you know, anyway, that's my point of view too.
But can't that just be explained by the rapacious greed of the music industry? They just want to find the next big thing that they can promote, package in a particular way that will generate masses of record sales. So, you know, if it's to their advantage that there's a massive pool of talent. They only need to find a few examples that they can pick out and promote in a particular way.
The money is important because the whole formula is control file and bribery. Take the bribe or the control file comes out and we, you know, the kiddie porn on the computer thing. Or we tie you up with electrical cord around a tree and you committed suicide with a shotgun 30 feet away.
Or the Kanye thing, right? With his handler saying, oh, we'll drug you into oblivion like we did last time.
Right. Very important. Good point. So,
I'm not saying those things. I'm not denying that these things happen. I'm just, again, it's my general point is that there's too much happening within any particular artistic medium for it all to be co-opted and controlled. You know, there's
too much for you to control. You can't perceive it because you can't imagine any one person controlling it. But this is orders within orders within orders. This is bubbles within bubbles within bubbles of organization, ultimately control. And that's where we get towards this, what we started off with, which is the Naomi Wolf piece saying, is this a return of the old gods? In other words, to have this level of sophistication and have this level of consistency intergenerationally speaks to an other worldly or other than human intelligence to organize, but then to create the structure of control is actually very human, having quasi-independent bubbles of orders interact. And that's also how the Masonic thing was explained, that I understand it, which is this whole degree thing is fine, but this 33rd degree isn't the end of it. That's just the beginning. A circle has 360 degrees. So if they're all about geometry, the big G, then what is the point of stopping at 33? And that is, in fact, the threshold by which then you are selected to go into other orders, and depending on your skills and talents and abilities. And so you might not be aware of someone else in another order, but you might be 40th degree, but not be aware of someone else's 50th degree next over here. But who's pulling all that together? You can't conceive of the fact that that all creativity is controlled. I'm not saying that. What I think Josh is also suggesting too is that the public facing stuff that's consumed and we're told and trained to learn and to like and value as the state of the art or the gold standard, if you will, that all is purposefully put out there for our consumption. And that's something, again, Plato talked about. Music is too important and has too much of an impact on the human mind and emotion for it to not be controlled. So if that was discussed 2,500 years ago, they've had a lot of time to perfect their control mechanisms for that.
And a 33rd degree system also speaks to the intergenerationality of the order as well, where there are things that you would potentially put in place and then carry on through your bloodlines, through your children, so that there's certain thresholds you can't pass, but your children would be able to pass if they've been indoctrinated into the same order. And you also have to look at like the spiritual side of it, where there are other entities and spirits involved with human development, and how much of it is put in place here now versus pre-planned in another realm or dimension, and how much communication back and forth is there. And you can't disregard the fact that black magic has been practiced for a long time, and there are people that have been utilizing it for nefarious purposes. And to think that musicians aren't groomed and created the same way politicians are. You remember that photograph of like all of the EU leaders at the moment during like the COVID crisis? All of those were photographed together, when they're mm-hmm. 7 years old or 10 years old or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a long play to have all those people being groomed at the same time for something that they're going to do 40 years from now.
Yeah, Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics, which is a known university for this sort of thing we're talking about.
And the real tell in that is not to not ignore astrology, because a lot of these people are even conceived on specific events, or they are triggered to enter this world at certain times, or when they go through their vetting process of like, oh yeah, who's going to actually make the final cut? We're going to choose this. We're going to choose this person because they're rising sign, right? Trump in his rising sign and his overall horoscope, right, matched the Great American Eclipse. How much of that was written into the stars thousands of years ago, and when was that really brought to fruition? Same thing with Biden's chart, the Sag rising. You have this marker of why these people are where they are at this moment.
And which how much of which of the 17 Bidens you talking about, Josh?
Oh my goodness. Is that crazy? They just line up all of the images you have
of all of the world
leaders. And you look over all the inconsistencies.
With the pretty ears. Striking. See that pretty clearly. The earlobes giveaway.
Cheekbones, ears.
That montage, was it you that put up, Jeff, of all the Bidens?
Josh,
I mean, when you look at all that, there are quite profound anatomical differences between them. seems to me. I mean, that can't just be differences of the light or different times of the day when his facial muscles were, you know, composed in a slightly different way or whatever.
Probably are these are different. We are the Biden.
Resistance oh, and that neck thing too. you guys see the neck thing with the idea that some of them were actually wearing facial prosthetics.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a couple of them where you can kind of see a little ripple on the neckline.
Borla, yeah, he's famous for that.
Borla's moving goiter. Yeah. Oh,
so the idea of, you know, the doppelgangers actually having masks. But, you know, just, yeah, how easy that freaking gig would be, huh? Wear this and just act like an idiot. Mumble everything you say. You know, you used to actually have to work, like, on, you know, getting the cadence right and actually sounding, you know, presidential. Yeah. Now you just, you know, get up there and sound like a senile old man. Oh, fantastic.
Not sure exactly.
This pays a couple hundred grand for this? Oh, this is wonderful.
How about the stumbling up the stairs again on the plane and then showing up with the bruise?
Oh, yeah, and throw in a couple stumbles, too, for good measure.
Yeah. And the bruise in the forehead from coming back from Kiev. Did you notice that?
Oh, yeah, yes. Got whack, bumped.
Someone popped him in the head saying, "Stop being stupid, you moron."
I really cannot listen to whoever it is that's being Biden. I can't listen to the guy's voice. You know, well,
just wait, right? I mean, Kamala. That's where the real magic is.
Oh, God, no.
And then it blasts off to space.
Someone put out their serious.
Your explanation of the rocket taking off? My goodness.
Someone put out there seriously they think she microdoses, and they weren't kidding. And he said, like, it almost explains her way of speaking by thinking she's, like, you know, just taking acid every day.
Yeah.
And which is a whole other side of, you know, just the drug culture that's happening, right? Depriving morality and ambition. It was another play on Ukraine too, with how DuPont and Cargill and one of those other big places is bringing in or buying. You know, hundreds of thousands of hectares of farmland at a discount in Ukraine, something like $2,000 per hectare. It was something like 1/3 the price of normal farmland in Europe.
Yeah.
I think they're growing cannabis like year round now.
Okay.
Some nice Chernobyl radioactive cannabis.
Gotta cure the cancer that it causes.
All in one, gives you and cures cancer in the same vape.
Yeah, so that's just, you know, another play.
What was that term you just used earlier? We're talking about astrology, Josh. The Great American Eclipse?
Yeah, the one in 2016. You know, solar eclipses when it blocks out the sun are pretty ominous and not very common. That happened in 2016. Or you get your special eclipse shades and go out and check it out, whereas in olden times, people would run into caves to hide from it. Now we celebrate it.
There's another one coming up, right, in a couple of years? A
couple of years. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Actually, we'll see it pretty good up north where I am.
Will you? Well, do you remember the 2016 eclipse?
Yeah, I remember pretty well.
Was the sun completely obscured for a short time?
It was.
So
it was crazy dark, you know, for, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds.
We had one here in about 1999 or 98, I think.
Wave there.
Hello.
Yeah, she wanted to wave.
Yeah, we can wave
back. Camera. Yeah. She's up early.
Yeah.
But we all.
It is bizarre. That going. Well, it didn't go dark. It went like twilight here. It was. I think it was almost a full eclipse. That everything goes ominously quiet as well, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, because all the insects are like, oh, crap.
Yeah.
Not this again.
Oh, they think it's the next end of the world.
Yeah, ooh, for good reason. Talk about a reset.
Oh, no. Another magnetic excursion? Oh, no.
I still like that movie what was it? I forget. I had the shoot. It'll come to me. Movie about, Pitch Black.
Yeah.
It was a terrible movie, but they had in the beginning, you know, the people that were, you know, on that planet beforehand apparently were alive long enough to figure out, you know, planetary alignments. And it was just always really neat I think we've talked about this before, the different mechanisms that you can buy and have that show how planets revolve around each other, that type of thing. They had one on the table that that showed how, you know, every so often the planet would be completely hidden from its suns, cast into total pitch blackness. And you know, one of the reasons why they weren't going to make it is because there's something else underneath the crust that comes out at that dark. You ever see the movie The Descent? Other things that live under the ground.
Yeah,
a good one. A team of hikers. I think it might have been all girls, actually. Like four girls, you know, going out climbing, and they descend down a pit and meet things down there. Very interesting movie.
I tell you, there's an interesting little anecdote about that film. It came out around the time of the London tube bombings, and the bus that blew up in Tavistock Square, you know, there were bombs on the tube trains, and there was one London bus that was blown up. You know the bare bones of the story, I imagine. What you may not know is that on the side of that bus was a big banner promoting this movie, The Descent, and the tagline for the movie was "Outright terror, bold and brilliant." Is that a coincidence?
That is a real aggressive marketing campaign. Yeah.
Very interesting as well. Little telltale signs that bus was rigged to beforehand to blow up in a particular way.
Even
down to looks like they used an angle grinder to weaken the structure so that whatever the explosive was went off, that it was designed to actually blow the roof off the top of the bus to make it dramatic.
I didn't know that. They actually had pictures of cuts made by a tool beforehand.
Just like the girders were cut at the base of the towers on 9/11. You know, you can see the V-shaped cuts that obviously were there to facilitate the collapse. Exactly the same thing.
That happened naturally from jet fuel.
Of course it did. It
traveled 100 stories down and melted things on a perfect 45 degree angle.
Perfect. Yeah, of course it happens all the time. There's have you come across in relation to the whole COVID thing, an Irish calls himself a data analyst, a guy called Ivor Cummings. I don't know if I've posted anything about.
Don't know the name.
Okay, he's been very good on demystifying all the data and pointing out.
Ivor, yes, I do remember seeing that name. Yes. There is only one Ivor out there. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
I think you might be right.
Substack, right?
Yeah, and he's done. You know, his videos are up on YouTube because he's very careful not to say things that trigger the algorithm.
I have a hard time with YouTube just because of the time. And if you're on YouTube, you can only watch YouTube. It's like you can't do anything else. That's why I have a hard time with videos as compared to audio or reading. But anyway, go ahead, please.
It's just very quickly. He rather stupidly and ill-advisedly ventured opinions about 9/11 recently, and he's drawn up what he thinks is a clever sort of toolkit for identifying genuine conspiracies as opposed to just conspiracy theories that can be dismissed. So it's his tool of sort of rational inquiry by which you work your way into a particular subject, and you can sort of deconstruct it using his toolkit.
Okay.
So it's a plausible. I'll try and find the video and I'll put it up.
Okay.
So he uses it to analyze 9/11, and it just comes to grief very, very quickly because he clearly isn't conversant with the evidence, nothing like sufficiently. So he's basically arguing from personal incredulity, you know, that the towers could have been blown up and, you know, exotic weaponry or devices might have been used, even, you know, mini nukes might have been used, all that kind of stuff, whatever. So purely from the basis of personal incredulity, he then uses his model to try and support his lack of conversance with the evidence. And so the comments are just brilliant to read afterwards. You know, there's everyone's weighed in, you know, and I have as well, of course. and he's responded to a few. And he's challenged about Building 7, because that's the one people use most generally to, you know, to sort of call it into question. And he said in response to Building 7, he said, yeah, Building 7 is a difficult one, but weird things happen. Those were his very words. This is a guy who claims to be driven by the data.
Thank you. So yeah. Now I know never to read this guy, because anyone who could say that is not worth listening to anything he says.
But it's just beyond belief that, you know, the guy who claims to be data driven and only concerned with facts can say weird things happen.
The data is that no other steel frame structure has ever collapsed in its own due to fire in history, and never since, never before, never since, only those three buildings.
Yeah.
So he's not data driven, because that's data.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it doesn't really want it then. Yeah.
Anyone who can say that to me doesn't deserve a minute of my attention anymore, because everything he says is suspect, because he's not clear thinking, obviously.
Is it possible? Give him some credit. He's just trying to cover himself and keep himself, you know, legitimate.
Either he's a coward or he's an idiot.
It is bizarre, I must say. Very strange.
To me, I'm like, thank you for revealing exactly who you are and who you work for by those comments, because now I'm not wasting my time thinking that you're actually legitimate, because I hate when I think someone's legitimate and then I have to discover this, like, after I've wasted hours and hours of my time, and then I have to, you know, cut them loose. This guy, at least, thank you for sharing that. Now I know not even to bother reading anything he writes.
But isn't that your blanket dismissal of him? Isn't that a little bit similar to suggesting that all artistic endeavor is controlled? Aren't you betraying your own mindset a little bit there? That, you know, that
I can't trust the judgment of someone who thinks that buildings fall down due to just someone, you know, blowing on them too hard, or, you know, someone dropping like a charcoal briquette and then it just melts the entire building down.
Can we not at least give him the credit for some of the stuff that he's done? I mean, do we have to dismiss?
Yes.
I think you're harsh, Jeff.
Yes, I am. And these times require a bit of a harsh sort of, if you're going to put yourself out there as someone worth reading and have your own Substack and claim to be some sort of authority or educated head that people should pay attention to, then you can't be a moron. And anyone who says Building 7, you know, is explainable through shit happens is a moron.
It is bizarre. And he hasn't, as far as I know, certainly not on the YouTube thread anyway, he hasn't sought to qualify or clarify his views, so it is strange.
I'm sorry, I cannot suffer fools gladly. and the stakes are too high now to even allow any sort of mercy on poor thinking and poor reasoning. Like at best Ivor is showing poor reasoning skills, and at worst he's controlled lifetime actor, controlled opposition type.
I want to give him some benefit of the doubt and prefer to say he just isn't familiar enough with the evidence.
Have you ever walked inside a skyscraper? Have you ever walked inside a skyscraper?
I remember looking up at the Empire State Building when I was in New York for one morning before going up to Maine for summer camp.
How can you not walk up to a skyscraper and walk through the lobby of a giant building and appreciate the massive, awesome effort it took to create such a durable pinnacle of technological advancement? I mean, the World Trade Center, I never was in Building 7, but I understand it was built the same way. Mm-hmm. Massive, massive steel columns. I mean, with a perimeter that was like 30 feet in perimeter, right, Josh? The main columns were at least 10 feet on each side, if not more. Solid steel columns, 30, 40 feet in perimeter, which would be a 10-foot or more, 15-foot, 20-foot diameter. And then a single jet with a single tank of gas, which is fuel oil, which is what people heat their homes with and burn in their own homes, just somehow caught on fire and melted 100 stories of these columns that are 40 feet in diameter. And I'm sorry, there was how many of them? I think 8 central columns and then smaller ones all along the external part of it. And, yeah. and a tank full of gas melted them down to nothing. I'm sorry, that only happened in 2 of them. The World Building 7 just had some fire fall on it from the other buildings, and that melted those columns down to nothing. That's what Ivor is saying. Ivor is a fucking moron.
It's a lot of paper in that building. It was 2001. You know, it was before digitization. You know, everyone had paper in the file cabinets.
That's right.
Reams and reams of paper.
Manila files burn at like 10,000 degrees. I forgot about that.
Well, when you have a lot of it.
It's basic chemistry, Nick. 9/11 is explained easily through basic chemistry.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong, Jeff. I mean, you know, I don't know whether I've looked into much detail, but I do know that all the arguments, and I know why there's no way that fire-induced fire caused damage possibly have led to the collapse like that.
So how can Ivor say he's data-driven when he ignores the rules of chemistry?
It is bizarre. It's bizarre. But, I mean, I remember having a conversation with an architect. This was the husband of a friend of my ex-wife's. This was going back quite a few years. Well, it was back when I first started looking at 9/11 in detail, around 2008. And this guy was an architect, very well trained, knows about stresses in buildings and how forces are, dealt with, all that kind of stuff. And I mentioned about the towers, and he said, without even blinking, he said, I can perfectly well understand why those towers collapsed the way they did.
Well, he's an imbecile.
That was what he had to, yeah. But Joshua was an architect.
Well, I don't care. He's an imbecile.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, but he meant it sincerely. So what's going on there?
I mean, he's a sincere imbecile.
Architects don't do their own structure. You sub it out to an engineer.
Right. Yeah.
No one wants that liability. Yeah. You had 1,000 feet long, right? Just pieces of steel all up and down that building.
Anyone who's ever built anything, even out of wood, has to recognize how difficult it is to burn something down to nothing. Even a wood structure is hard to burn down. You have to really try to burn something down. You have to be careless. You have to have a lot of fuel. You have to have a lot of oxygen. But when you get into steel structures,
and it was Japanese steel too. That steel came from Japan because they were the only ones that were able to make them that long. Because they did several stories at a time and welded them together.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Just like the jib jab, 9/11 ignorance to me is that tells me whether or not I need to pay any attention to you whatsoever, because I don't have time to listen to anyone who can't think clearly about that. Time is too short now for me to have to explain basic chemistry to people.
Yeah, I agree. 9/11 and COVID are the litmus tests for whether you should entertain.
I'm sorry. You know what? Before COVID, I had a lot more patience to go through everything because I felt like we still had time. But now school is out and I don't have time for people. And if they haven't done the study themselves, I don't have time anymore to sit and hold their hand through the whole thing. I did that with my wife, and I can't do it with any more people.
Yeah.
I've run out of gas.
Yeah. I mean, the best, when I was reading these, what he said, and then the comments in response, I found myself thinking, well, the best I can hope for is that he will take on board what people are saying to him in these comments, and then go away and do some proper study. And then come back and admit he was wrong.
And in the meantime, shut down your internet blog because you're not worth reading, because you obviously can't think clearly about anything. That's my point of view. Don't even pretend. Don't even put it out there to lure people and to waste their time, because you're not worth reading if you can't think clearly.
I get it, Jeff. I get it. I do. And I'm broadly of the same mind. I just will cut people a bit more slack than you're prepared to, I think.
Not anymore. Time's up. Time is up.
So where do we go from there then?
To the bathroom. Be right back.
How are your kids these days, Josh? Are they all well? Are they
They had a little vacation this week.
Mm-hmm.
And today is vacation. today's
vacation.
Today's Saturday. Back to school on Monday.
Is that what do they call this? The week they've just had off. Has it got a name?
Some type of winter recess.
Okay. So do they get that? Do you get like a longer holiday at Christmas and Easter, and then a week in between? Is that how it works?
Something like that. Yeah, because they'll have another week off in April.
What? That's the Easter holiday, is it?
I don't know if they time it with Easter.
Okay.
They should, but I'm not sure.
Right. I think Easter is early April, isn't it, this year?
You know, I mean, it's 40 days from now, but I don't know the date offhand.
Okay. How do you know it's 40 days from now?
Oh, it was just Ash Wednesday.
Ah, okay.
Curiously, yeah, we'll have a Venus retrograde this year. That's also 40 days and 40 nights.
Okay.
So Easter is April 9th this year.
But that's the Sunday.
Oh, yeah. Easter Sunday. Yeah.
Right. Okay. April 9th.
Yeah. It's always 40 days after Ash Wednesday.
Yeah.
Which is astrologically based as well.
I know. That always struck me as very strange that it's to do with the phases of the moon, isn't it?
Yeah. Religion always tied to the stars.
Yeah. You'd think that they would have tried to get away from that.
Why?
Yes.
It's the premise. The three kings, right? Orion's belt. So it's literally tracking the history of our world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Where's Grandpa? You miss him? Yeah.
We never go there.
Do you know where he lives now?
Yes. Virginia Capital Richmond.
Francis knows all of his capitals now.
Excellent.
Okay, that's too much because you're getting your hand covered with black marker. All right, I'm going to have to go, guys.
Yeah.
Got the whole clan now.
Yeah.
You want to wrap it up for today?
I will. You guys can hang on.
Jeff?
Until next time.
Yeah, take it easy, Josh.
Yep, see you guys.
If you can.
See ya.
It's all good. Bye.
Yeah, see ya.
Yeah, I mean, I have time if you're up for it. If not, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm not going anywhere.
Yeah, I know. I get a bit aggressive on my point of view with that. It's just I get frustrated constantly having to explain what I think should be common sense to people when it comes to 9/11. It just if it didn't wake you up, then I don't know if there's a common ground for me to have a conversation with someone other than the most superficial, trivial, like how's the weather and oh nice to see you and can I borrow a cup of milk is about the extent of what I can do.
Yeah,
because
I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's a litmus test for do you have rational thought and
are you prepared to be brave in your thinking? Are you, like you said, I think earlier on, you know, this willingness to step out, like I think that great analogy you used before about jumping out of the plane without the parachute.
Yeah.
You know, are you brave enough to trust your judgment that you'll figure something out on the way down and you're not just going to splat into the ground? You know, it's that willingness to step into the void and be unanchored for a while.
Yeah. The couple I was telling you about last night, we even discussed this a little bit. And I admitted to the group, and my wife knows this about my history, when it first happened, I was like, turn that place to glass, meaning the Middle East, because that was my initial reaction. And you know, at the time, I still had some semblance of belief that we had a government that actually did things and was responsible and in control and overall had, you know, best interests of the country at heart.
Yeah.
And over the course of 6 months is when I began to change my perspective, when all of a sudden I'm like, wait a second, they're saying what? And because they couldn't hide the inconsistencies for very long. But, you know, the more, if you had any kind of curiosity about the details, once you started getting into the details, you're like, Wait, hang on a second. So those buildings were already designed to withstand the plane hitting it? Okay, I didn't realize that. And that was plainly said.
Multiple
planes. And they said, oh, but yeah, but that was, you know, way back when in the 70s. And then it's like, but wait a second. The planes that hit were actually smaller than the planes they were designed to withstand back in the 70s. So that doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, well, if they got that wrong, that's pretty careless. Is that just simply someone, you know, screwing up, making a mistake? And that's when you start thinking, can people
an authority make such basic errors, or is that a lie?
Yeah.
And again, because of my unique sort of situation growing up, believing everyone's lying to me all the time, it wasn't hard to then say, okay, now if they're lying, what else are they lying to me about? And that mm-hmm. just, like you, was like the accelerant that just went whoosh, and I just couldn't get enough at that point. And that's when I was like, oh my God, who killed John O'Neill?
Yeah. First day on the job, wasn't it?
Huh? Yes.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
First day on the job.
Yeah.
That initial sniffing of bullshit, you know, that first detection of a lie, however small, that's the bit of grit that then has the potential to escalate.
Yeah.
But what really interests me is how people won't even allow, you know, the hint of deception to enter their consciousness because of what it will trigger, you know, that cascade of further connections.
I think you recognize that if I continue along this path, I am giving up every single belief that I've ever had, and I'm letting go of that security blanket like we talked about earlier, and it's not easy to do. As late as 2004, I borrowed the audiobooks from my boss of Clinton's autobiography that he wrote. So I was still believing the Clinton bullshit as late as 2004. So I'm not saying that I'm Mr. Perfect and I'd known all this all along. What I'm saying is, in the face of obvious evidence, if you continue to then defend the bullshit story, then I have no time for you. I heard Clinton narrate in his own words his own story, and then I got to hear the other side, and I chose to believe the other side and not say, no, you know, I know Clinton, and he's a good guy. No, you know, the other evidence was overwhelming against.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing that's most against Ivor Cummings is that, you know, we've had over 20 years of evidence gathering and pretty much, I would say, you know, as far as you could say, we know that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill Kennedy. It's as conclusive as that the towers did not fall according to the officials. Yeah. And if Cummings is still holding to the idea that Building 7 fell because weird things happen, that does suggest that there's a faulty intellect there at the very best.
It's a childish explanation.
Shit happens. And why admit it? Why state it like that? Anybody looking at that YouTube video can read that comment, and it's there in black and white. He's essentially admitted that he's not capable of even a sort of modest level of logical reasoning.
He never saw loose change. He never saw all these interviews of New York Fire Department people talking about bombs exploding. Yeah. You know, he never heard of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Yeah. I mean, he's never heard any of the other arguments and said, well, despite all that, I still think that a tank full of jet fuel, which is kerosene, mm-hmm. which burns, mm-hmm. I think, at 800 degrees Celsius, and did all that. And their whole argument that it weakened the steel is again, just a silly sort of childish way to force your theory, you know, into the existing facts. And okay, so it weakened the steel. It weakened 1,000 feet of steel. Mm. And then that weakening caused it to just magically compress and disappear and vaporize. It caused these beams to eject in a parabolic manner, which indicates through force.
Yeah.
I mean, you can see on a close ups of the collapse. You can see the and these are things that weigh tons being ejected out in a parabolic upward.
I know. But I mean, it took me years. You know, I said it was 2008 before I started seriously looking at the arguments of the opposition. And I mean, it didn't take me long to see that all their arguments were way better founded than the official story. But it still, nevertheless, took me seven years or thereabouts.
Well, you're battling against the pinnacle of electronic propaganda. I mean, they had the psychic driving of the planes constantly hitting those towers. They showed you over and over again.
Yeah. I remember, I think I told you that I was watching the TV on the morning it was happening live. I just happened to be at home that day.
Yeah.
And I had the TV, and these were in the days when I watched TV news. And yeah, the BBC were covering it. And thinking back now, there was a sense of weird unreality about the way the BBC was covering it. Like, do you remember they had the anchors in the studios after the first plane hit, and they were talking, and they had the screen in the background with the tower, North Tower burning, mm-hmm. South Tower unstruck, you know, intact.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're talking, there's no reaction. This cartoon plane flies in across the screen and goes behind the North Tower, and then you see the fireball on the South Tower. And it's several seconds before anybody in the studio reacts. I was thinking, what's going on? There's just been an explosion, and it looked like a plane caused. Why aren't they reacting immediately in the studio?
Right.
You know, and then you hear them saying, oh, and we're just getting reports that a second plane has hit the South Tower. This weird sort of disconnect in time, you know, really strange.
Yeah. Well, you know, they're not professional Oscar-winning actors. And so when they read the script, it depends on the quality of the director giving the direction, I guess, through the little earpieces. You know, obviously it's screwed up with the Building 7 thing when that woman said how it already collapsed and it's sitting there visible behind her.
The immortal Jane Stanley.
Yeah, who disappeared, right?
And she went off to some other job. I forget what it was. She did go somewhere else. But, the other thing about that was the way they lost the live feed. Conveniently lost the live feed just in the minutes before they brought the tower down, before they brought Building 7 down.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would have been too too much of a reveal. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't lose a live feed on national broadcast news unless you want to.
Yeah. Nick, it's a crazy world outside.
Oh yeah. But it's great news that you've got allies on the ground now, where you live.
It's been extremely gratifying, and I even shared it with them last night. I said, there's not a day that goes by that I have any regret on what we did in terms of moving here, and that's pretty rare. Usually with any decision, you're like, if only I would have done this a little bit differently, it could have been a little better. I'm like, no, this has been absolutely the best thing I've done in response to the circumstances. And it keeps getting reinforced by the people we're meeting. And it's amazing how the people we're meeting all are interconnected with the people who, like, I'm finding. What I'm also finding is that you better make sure you have a good reputation here, because once people know of you, you're spoken about, because they're like, who was your real estate person? When you mentioned real estate, oh yeah, we know Laura Beth, her child went to school with our kid, and they're going to Montana, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, wow. It's like around here, you are known. People talk about you and you are known. It's like there's definitely a characterization about you. And so you need to make sure you carry yourself properly in a small town, country you live in here.
That ties in with what we were talking about before, right, early on. the willingness to abide by standards of behavior that, mm-hmm. that you will, if you don't, you're going to be severely compromised.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that interesting thing between your internal moral compass, like you talked about, the virtue kind of being its own reward in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it needs to be shared throughout a community, mm-hmm. to have real substance. It has to be shared. And there has to be a sense of, there will be consequences that other people will know about this. If I don't abide by these codes of behavior, I will suffer. In the hands of the community.
If I shared this already, let me know. But when I went to get my quad from the dealer, I was talking to the guy about where I lived, because we talked about delivery. And he's like, oh, yeah, I know the area. And he brought up, so-and-so. And I'm like, I don't know them. I said, I know, but we live down the road from, and I brought up the guy's name, because his family name is, I've seen in other places, including with the rec center. And his reply to that was, oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Like I feel bad for you. And I was like, whoa, he doesn't even live in this town, and yet he knew of this guy, and he obviously was speaking in a negative, you know, pejorative sort of sense. And we've only interacted with them through a brief note. And actually, they gave us cookies at Christmas because we gave everyone Christmas cards introducing ourselves. And most, about half people ignored us. And they at least gave us a set of cookies that the wife had cooked with their mom.
Yeah.
But we haven't met him in person. But my point being, if you act a certain way in this town and your name gets on the hot sheets, you know, you're going to be... people are going to know where you live, who your neighbors are, and have a quick thumbnail about what they think of you.
You don't know what it is that he's done that might have led to this.
He didn't offer. I didn't ask. Yeah.
But you haven't had a chance to form your own opinion because you've not met him.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. I'd be interested to hear what your perception of him is if you ever do get to interact. You know.
Probably less likely because a relative of his was the guy who was cutting our lawn. And when we first moved down here, I met with him and I asked him about doing a fall cleanup because we had shit ton of leaves and I wasn't equipped to even handle it at that point in time. And so he was supposed to come back and give me a price and start the work. And we didn't hear from him for like a month. And so in the meantime, I'd gotten a blower and I decided to take it on myself. And so he finally got back to us like a month later and he's like, oh, well, you know, I just want to talk to you about the fall cleanup. I'm like, well, sorry, but I already bought a blower and I did it myself. He's like, oh, okay. I said, well, we didn't hear from you. We just assumed that you weren't interested in the job. He's like, oh, no, I got sick. And so, you know, I wasn't able to really, I'm like, you were sick for a month and you couldn't text and you're a business owner. It's like, come on. That's. And now since then I've gotten a ride on mower that I'm going to be doing my own lawn. So we're going to completely cut ties with the guy. So he's a relative of the with the same last name as my neighbor. Okay. So I'm probably going to have less chance for interaction with that family now.
Yeah, that's handy if they've all got the same name, same surname. It's like, okay.
It's a small town, you know, like I said, you want to make sure that you're carrying yourself appropriately in public because eyes are on you.
And even more so, you being out of towners, out of status even, you're going to be quite prominent, aren't you? And people are going to be talking about you probably more than you might guess even.
Yes, and physically we stand out apparently because my wife said that as we were walking out of the restaurant last night, someone was like, "Oh, some weird people around here lately." I know, I didn't catch it, but my wife dresses in a way that's much different than the people around here. She has a sense of fashion and style, and most people here don't in terms of how they dress. They dress very country casual, like with baseball hats and just cheap clothes, you know. And she was wearing a dress with like big boots last night, and so. No other girl was wearing a dress like hers in the restaurant, and I was wearing a nice button-down shirt. And you know, I don't know. Somehow, I guess what we've heard is that our energy is different. Like people perceive us at the rec center. We heard from one of the ladies like, "Oh, people are talking." But you know, it's all the new kid in town syndrome.
Yeah. I'd be interested to know, how many others have thought similarly to yourselves and decided that Withville was a better alternative to New York or, you know, the Northeast states. Have you come across any others that have moved, relocated to that part of Virginia?
Not who've done it recently and not that I'm aware of in the same sort of reasons. But again, it's not something you bring up quickly in casual conversation, which is, oh yeah, we fled because everyone was paranoid and making us wear masks and you know, wanting us to be jib-jabbed and wagging their fingers at us because we weren't. That can't really come up. That's what I was surprised about was how even here it's a secret society of – and the guy even said, I'm a pure blood. I'm like, I didn't expect to hear that from you. And not because I didn't expect not to have taken the jab. I didn't expect it to be like a mark of I'm part of the secret society of pure bloods type of thing.
Yeah. Is are they the same age or similar age?
They're my wife's age. The husband is same age as Christine, and his wife is a few years younger. So I'm the old man in the group.
Okay. So how does that make you feel then?
I don't give a fuck, you know, whatever.
I like them. I like mixing with younger people is good. I get a real buzz out of it, you know. So it's one of the reasons I like the fact that Josh and Jan are in this Saturday group.
Yes.
You know, bring some youthful vitality. And we bring the mess, middle-aged cynicism. And
yeah.
Not that I'm probably less cynical than Josh, I think, but by the sounds of it. But
yeah, I've pretty much poisoned him pretty good against modern society.
Yeah, you must have been fun to be around in the early days.
Well, when I was drinking, yeah, it was a lot more fun. Yeah, a lot of laughs until I drank too much. I remember I said to Josh, I was like, listen, I've been doing a lot of research on stuff, and let's put it this way. What I could tell you is definitely going to change your way of thinking of things, and it might not be good, and it might actually scare the hell out of you, and it might not be good, and I might be wrong, but if you're interested, I can start sending you some stuff. He was like, oh, yeah. I did try to warn him.
How old was he at the time?
This was back when I started, you know, figuring things out, so early 2000s.
So what is he, 2003? Is he 35?
2003. He's born in 86, 96. Nah, he was probably 18 when I started sharing this kind of stuff.
Oh, it was a good age to start.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to do too soon.
No, it's like with my daughter now. She's been pretty well prepped, you know, with the way I think, without being, you know, laying it on, you know, really thick. But now I can almost take it for granted that she will have, you know, that she'll be looking for a different angle on any given news story, you know, not because I've indoctrinated her, but because she's been exposed to a way of thinking that she finds it just makes more sense for her than just blindly believing the authorities.
Right. And also, you can't force it either. If someone truly is into it, it'll snowball on its own.
Yeah.
And you know, like with Josh, once I got the ball rolling with him, he then verified things that I was saying, which I wanted him to. He found stuff that I wasn't aware of, and it became a back and forth, a conversation rather than a lecture.
Yeah.
And you know, like I said to him, like I said to my wife, I was like, listen, I would like nothing more than to find out in 20 years that I was wrong about everything. And everyone laughs and says, oh, Jeff, remember how crazy you were with all these crazy theories that went nowhere? I said, believe me, that would be the best outcome, is I find out that I was a stupid lunatic who was worrying about the sky falling and it didn't. And the unfortunate thing is that, nope, I was exactly right and spot on and continue to be. And we're fucked. So let's let's deal with that right now.
Yeah, it is. There is a grim satisfaction in it that has to be said.
Yeah, but you know, that's when you have to get a bit spiritual and a bit philosophical and think that, you know, what is life? What is the purpose of life? How long does life last? And what is the expectation for us while we're incarnate? And you're gonna have to die of something.
Do you spend much time thinking about your mortality?
Every day I think about death, Nick, and I'm not exaggerating.
I think I do too. I think it's healthy.
I think you need to, and that's what I learned in the last 15 years was that I'm gonna quote Captain Kirk here: how we think about death is at least as important as how we think about life. It defines us. Mm. Our mortality defines us, and if you insist on living at any price just to keep living in what you think is a certain way, then you're going to be, you know, controlled as a slave. If you recognize that how you live is more important than just living.
Yeah. I think it's something that does become, if you're of a particular cast of mind, like it seems we are, it becomes that much more poignant as you advance through life, that sense of your own mortality and reflecting on it and ignore. Can you hear that beeping in the background?
Yeah, what is it? Yeah.
My bread maker.
Ah.
It's just finished baking a loaf.
What kind of loaf?
I was a wholemeal brown loaf. Oh. Very nice flour. Yeah. I was a bit worried, actually, because for some reason or other, my bread makers have become temperamental. I think it must be the CPU that is beginning to degrade.
And it doesn't always.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's 5 years old now. So I worked out it's probably baked in the region of, it's roughly 100 loaves a year, two a week, I reckon. So that's 500 loaves of bread it could have made in the time I've had it. So whether the CPU just starts to degrade, and because it doesn't always go through every bit of the cycle, it will do the kneading and it'll do the proving. And then for no reason that I couldn't anticipate, it just decides to stop and not go through to the bake cycle. And then at that point, you've got to take it out of the bread maker, stick it in the oven and finish baking it in the oven.
Oh, the horror.
Yeah, but it is frustrating because you don't get such a good loaf. But this one, it seems to have gone through today, you know, miracle of miracles. So that's good. So, yeah, things wear out. Things wear out and break down. And the human body is no different. But I was going to ask you that the sense of your own mortality, it becomes more acute, doesn't it, as you get older? But at the same time, it makes life feel all the sweeter, which is this strange, it's the strange kind of paradox.
Yeah.
The more aware you are of the imminence of death, the more sweet life feels.
Right. And I know these are empty words unless you actually have to go through with it. The problem is that once you have to go through with it, you know, it's kind of like a cartoon. I remember with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, where in the end, Daffy Duck did this great thing and he ended up exploding himself. And Bugs Bunny was like, fantastic, Daffy. Great, great. He's like, yeah, I can only do it once, though. That's the problem. As he's flying off to heaven. So it's one thing to say I'm not afraid of dying, but then when you're facing it, are you going to be afraid of dying? Because right, it's easy to say when you're sitting comfortably in your living room and drinking a cup of coffee, like, oh yeah, death, I'm not scared of death. But as you face it. But I have had times where I've been in danger, in real serious danger, and things could have gone badly, and I kept my wits about me, and I didn't have a panic. I didn't have a fear. One time I almost choked to death.
Really?
And I was actually on the phone with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time. I was in my house in New York before she moved in with me. And I was eating a steak. I thought I told this story.
No.
I barbecued a steak, and apparently it was either a cheap cut or I didn't cook it enough. And it was a bit on the tough, rare side.
Yeah.
And I was talking to her, and I was eating, and I was just, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I took too big a bite. And it got stuck in my throat.
Oh my God! Wow.
And I'm on the phone. I'm like, and she's talking. And she's talking away. And I'm like, So at that moment, I stayed calm and I thought to myself, "You have one shot at this." I said so. And I learned this from my career, all the trainings I took with CPR and all that stuff. I was like, "You can't give yourself the Heimlich. The only thing you can do is get behind a chair and use the chair back to be the Heimlich." Pushing thing. So I stood up, put the phone down, went behind the chair and made sure I did it properly because I knew I only had one shot at it. And I went down hard on it. And sure enough, the thing expelled and came out. I was like, oh. So then I got back on the phone and my wife was still talking. I'm like, yep.
What was that? And the worst of it is, picked up the bit of meat and put it back in your mouth and carried on chewing.
No. That I had too gristly.
So when that happens, though, does it go down the windpipe rather than the gullet?
Yeah.
So you wow. So you can't even breathe through your nose.
No, I was locked up. I was completely locked up.
Wow.
And that's what my point is. I recognized it for what it was. I didn't panic, and I also knew. I'm like, this could be it. This could be it, but if you do this correctly, you might have a fighting chance. And sure enough, it actually worked better than I ever could have imagined. Because it's one thing to go through training about it, but another thing to do it and see that, you know.
Well, to have the presence of mind as well to not panic, because I mean, you know, that as soon as you feel like your breath is shut off, it's a natural, isn't it? The panic reaction would set in immediately.
I'm surprised it didn't.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised that it didn't. Obviously,
Well, that's the difference, isn't it? But you know, people say that the difference between living and dying in those situations is whether you avoid panicking or not.
Yeah.
Whatever, however, you know, whatever the circumstances may be, you've got to keep a clear head.
And also, had I not chosen the career field that I did, I maybe wouldn't have learned all the various CPR techniques, and I wouldn't have, and repeatedly, so they stuck with me, and been able to, through routine, just know that, oh, in this situation, you do this, and that's basically your only option. Because if there's no one around, there's no one to signal. Yeah. I couldn't tell her I need help. I couldn't hang up and then call 911 and expect that's going to work, because by the time they got to me, I'm brain dead. So all these things kind of just occurred to me like in a flash. And I'm like, you have one action you can do here to save yourself. So, but also,
how many seconds do you think elapsed between the moment when you realized it was stuck and the moment you freed it?
It went pretty fast. Because I didn't have any kind of lightheadedness. I didn't have any symptoms of anoxia. So it wasn't long enough that all of a sudden, you know, my oxygen supply was gone. So I still had enough in my lungs. I would say from beginning to end, under a minute. Because I pretty much knew. I diagnosed immediately what was the issue and knew exactly I had one solution. And I pretty much carried it out all within less than a minute.
Must have been less than a minute, because I mean you could have got it stuck on an out breath day when you've got less oxygen.
Oh, no, it was on an in breath, because I was talking, chewing, and then I breathed in, and it was like,
okay, so the fact that it was on an in breath,
right?
A minute still sounds like a long time. You know, I was thinking maybe only 10 seconds between, you know, realizing what had happened and getting
it was
getting
under a minute, possibly under 30 seconds. But again, you know, time sort of changes for you there. But I know that, and as long as it took me to tell you this story is how long the whole event took place. And my wife didn't notice a thing because she was still talking. She was still rattling on.
Did you say, I think I nearly died just now?
I waited a little bit and I was like, I don't know if I told her during the phone call or if I waited to like, oh, by the way, we were talking last night. I almost died. But I did tell her.
So she didn't spot anything wrong. Well, surely she must have realized that you weren't on the phone for that brief period that you were away.
She didn't realize.
Oh, my God. What does that say about women? It's like, do they really need an audience?
But also, to be fair, it wasn't that long. Like you said, 30 seconds. Yeah. She was in the middle of a story.
Yeah, I know. I'm being. Look, I'm a little bit cynical about women at the moment because I'm struggling.
Bitch. Yeah.
Yeah, her Mercedes. Was unreal. I mean, the most striking thing about that was the racism against the whole of Africa. I just thought that was staggering to come out with a statement like that. You know, to say that. You know, the whole of Africa is undeveloped, can't think clearly. Just shocking. There you go.
Well, I was also surprised that, as you said, my profile is very clear about who I am. You need to read it. And she obviously didn't read it, yet she said she did. It's like, how even dense. I can't understand it. I can't understand. But I guess it all goes together in the same sort of lazy thinking, you know, ascribing an entire behavior pattern to an entire continent, whether or not I agree with it or not. No one is trying to move to Africa, by the way. I just want to just point that out. No one's relocating there. And South Africa's not doing so good anymore since they kicked out the guys who used to run it. So, you know, I do have some strong opinions about that, but it's certainly not something to share with someone you just met.
No. I think all the signs are pointing towards, I think I mentioned I've got this friend, Polish friend, who I've been in contact with for several years. We'd never met. She moved to England about 4 years ago, and now she moved because she had a partner in this country who was Polish but working in England. I think, do you remember me telling you this?
Yes.
And So she shacked up with him for a while and it didn't really work out. They weren't really compatible. So she moved out and has got her own place. And she's just recently completed on a house. Sort of, it's all part of this big sprawling conurbation, Birmingham, Wolverhampton. It's like the New York metropolitan district, I suppose. You know, it's like blends into one, you know. He's bought a house kind of right in the middle of all this. Not where I would choose to be, but, you know, she's got to be close to where she works.
That's and, suburb.
But where she's bought is actually not bad. It's down a fairly quiet street that goes no through road, so you don't get lots of traffic going through.
Right.
And it's close to a canal, so it's you know, it's for city living, it's not that bad. And anyway, we started talking years ago when she was still living in Poland, but her English was good because she taught in a school there, and we've always got on, you know, and as time's gone by, it feels like I kind of know her kind of as well as I feel like I know you and Josh and Jan. Like, you know, it's like you get a sense of there's a relationship there, you know, even though you never met. And I know that she's got hopes that we might end up, you know, as a couple.
Okay.
And almost like the universe is saying to me, look, Nick, you've tried, you've been here, you've been there, you've dated this, you've dated that. And through all of it, there's been this one sort of constant presence. And you've always got on, you know, you like each other. What the hell's the problem? You know, why aren't you just admitting the obvious?
And you've met in person, physical person yet?
No.
Oh,
no.
Interesting.
No. I was due in the early days. I know what she looks like. You know, I nearly bought a ticket to go and see her in Poland in the early days, but it didn't happen. But she's only like, she's 30 miles up the road. So once she settled in with her house move, you know, because when she bought the place, it was left in a real state by the previous owner, you know, disgusting. So she's got a lot of cleaning and some decorating to do. But once that's settled down, I know she wants me to go and visit, you know, because she said so. And, you know, that will be the test. Do we actually like each other in, you know, is there any spark? Is there any chemistry?
Yeah, right.
And that's got to be there, obviously, even for a middle-aged man. I still want that to be there, you know.
Of course.
So, but that's what it feels like, you know, that's what it feels like the universe is telling me. You know,
how did you originally come to know her if she was already with another guy?
This was before she met him.
Oh,
she was in Warsaw in Poland working. She was on a British dating site, and which was one of the reasons we started talking. Is like, I was intrigued why she bothered putting her profile on a British dating site if she lived in Poland.
Reasonable question.
And she said that she had ambitions to move to, because she'd lived in England years before. And she always had an ambition to move back. So she was, I don't know, she was just amusing herself in the meantime, I suppose. And anyway, so that was the pretext by which we started talking initially. And
gotcha.
She's just straightforward, down to earth, no nonsense. You know, just something refreshingly, it's difficult to put your finger on it. I don't know whether, because Josh's wife is Polish, isn't she?
Yes.
I wonder whether he'd say something similar. There's something refreshingly, I don't know, almost like sort of almost an untainted quality about her. It's not naivety, but she hasn't been saturated with some of the kind of, you know, the decadence of the West.
Yes,
you
know? There's still a conservative, traditional life outlook that is more cemented in that culture, I think, the Polish culture, because Josh's wife and his mother-in-law and grandmother-in-law all still had that basic, simple but honorable sort of, you know, again, traditional Catholic upbringing type of thing. I can see nowadays, especially that sort of thing is more attractive because it's becoming so rare. And it's only now that people are realizing, you know, we were kind of hard on them and all the you know, the rules and the way in which they live. But in fact, that was the way to go. And for some, it's too late to get that back. But yeah, I agree. Yeah. If you find someone who has that sort of, you know, fundamental sort of morality and ethics that just is an easy part of who they are, and they don't, you know, wear it on their sleeve, you know, they don't wear it as a hair shirt, you know, constantly remind the world of it, but rather just through their actions. It's what I would look for if I were in your shoes. Absolutely.
Another aspect of it is, it's like she's not saddled with this over exaggerated sense of entitlement about what she should expect, you know, what she should demand either from a job or from life or from a man. You know, she doesn't seem to be saddled with those unrealistic expectations that so many Western women, Western people, but I'm specifically referring to Western women, you know,
humility just, you're talking about?
Yeah. You know, they're just like this woman I went on, you know, the pharmaceutical woman, you know, the bigoted pharmaceutical woman went on the date with last weekend. You know, it's just all of it seems to be, you know, this exaggerated sense of entitlement. It's really unattractive. I've never liked it, actually. I've never liked it in anybody. But in a woman, I find it particularly
it's an outgrowth of the feminist movement, which again was a cultural movement that was engineered and that organic.
Yeah, you're dead right. Yeah. I think it hasn't benefited women very much at all. And they've been fooled into thinking that it has, but it's been at the price of good relations with the opposite sex, I think, in many cases.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a lot of misery out there for people who, and too late that they realize, oh, maybe this was the wrong way to go, and it's too late by that point.
Yeah, I don't know whether there is a counter movement back. I'm too old to know.
I think there is.
I'd like to hope so.
Well, everything comes in cycles, so that's the hope that we have, which is, you know, the pendulum has swung so far, and we're astonished at how it can have gone so far, but yet it's that darkest before the dawn sort of perception where maybe it's on its way back, and we just don't realize the momentum has shifted yet.
Well, that sounds very close to you being optimistic there, Jeff. What's going on?
I'm a romantic at heart.
I know you are. I think you have to believe it, don't you? And I think that, you know, the history does teach us that things go in cycles, doesn't it? The pendulum never swings so far, it hasn't anyway, because otherwise we wouldn't be here. It never swings far in one direction that it's beyond the point of no return.
And despite them trying to make Tolkien now an author of the white supremacists, I'm reminded of Gandalf saying that, you know, it's not for us to question why, it's just for us to make the most of the time that we're given while we're here. And I'm not going to question why I was born in this time, but just know that I am, and it's up to me to make the best of it and do the best I can.
That is all we can do.
I feel grateful that I have a functioning brain that is able to evaluate things and able to change its stance and change its mind with new information coming in, because most people don't have that anymore.
Do you worry about losing your marbles?
I worry that I won't recognize it in time to commit suicide, because I won't exist on this planet a vegetable. That's not part of the deal that I signed up for. I will not be in a nursing home getting gruel fed to me through a tube. I will find my last bit of wits to shoot myself in the mouth with a shotgun and not tie myself to a tree.
You know that line from the Lynyrd Skynyrd song, when my time's up, I'll have my own, you won't find me in an old folks home.
Correct. I mean, I will do what I got to do, but one of the things I will not sign up for is living a dependent nursing home life. That is not, I have zero interest in that. And that's where I'm like, you know, it's time for me to go.
But the thing is, will you have enough? Well, this is the thing though, Jeff. And this is the thing that I worry about, is that will we have enough presence of mind to recognize the point at which, if we let it go any further, we won't be able to act anymore, because we'll have lost that autonomy.
I think the ability to ask that question and to be concerned about the answer is itself the answer. I think the answer is yes. Now we have the courage to actually pull off what is easy to say when you're healthy you know, I have the bravery of good health right now. Will I have that same bravery when I'm like, well, no, I can get by another year before I really decline much further, you know, or will I know, like, nah, I guess it depends.
I want to be, I hope I'm around when the time comes, not because I want to see you go. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to be laughing while Jeff puts the shotgun in his mouth. Yeah, that's not what I'm saying at all. It's more of a, you know, of a thought experiment. You know, will the impulse to stay alive override any kind of reasoning ability to, you know, make that decision that no, there's no more quality of life left for me now. It can only be further decline. So my reason says now's the time. Or is the impulse towards life too strong to be overridden?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would say in response, we both have stated that we think about our mortality on a daily basis, which is good practice. And number two, I've already had, like, that story I told you about with the choking to death thing. I've already seen that I won't panic in the face of possible death, or I haven't, at least in one specific example. So I'm encouraged that I'll be able to face it with a grim determination. And so far, so good, in the sense of I've been pretty lucky in the life I've lived so far. I've been given a lot of chances. I've been given a lot of chances to self-correct. And, you know, by the same token, I've also worked hard to, you know, play ball with the universe. I just hope that the universe gives me a graceful way out, or the opportunity to give myself a graceful way out. We'll see. But if I did find myself a prisoner in a nursing home, I've already spoken to Josh about this. I've said, like, you need to get me out of there and put a 45 in my hand, please. And so he knows my point of view on that whole thing.
Yeah.
Will he have the ability to, you know, be an accomplice in his dad's suicide? I don't know, but I hope he would if things get really bad.
Isn't Chrissy the more sort of pertinent person in this scenario?
Not for that. I think it's got to be blood.
Okay, but presumably Chrissy knows
does.
Desires, and
she does. But I also know a woman is a woman, and her heart's her heart. And if anyone would at the last minute try to, like, avoid that sort of thing under the guise of, you know, can't do it, you know, I would think anyway. I think it's more of a man's job.
Right.
That's my own sexism, I guess.
Well, I don't know if it's necessarily sexist. I mean,
I was accused of being sexist last night because I came out of the comments saying at the risk of being sexist, and I said something that was sexist. I'm like, there was no risk there. You were. But I was pointing out, like, a fundamental difference between men and women. I'm like, the fact is, a difference does not make it sexist. It's just, you know, a table is not a chair. Is that tableist? Am I being tableist by saying that?
Exactly. It's only sexist if you ascribe superior value to male traits.
Right. And I think in my example, I was actually denigrating men more so than women on that whole thing. Anyway. But...
I think we've got to get back to this, you know, not being afraid to talk about the differences between men and women, you know, and celebrating that difference rather than trying to obliterate it. You know, that's where it's all gone so badly wrong.
We're still battling courts that say it's okay for a man who decides to call himself a woman can compete in women's sports and win awards. Yeah. So when, you know, we have that kind of ridiculous insanity, you know, actually being affirmed by our judicial system, we have a long way to go before we get to what you just said.
Yeah, but I don't you get the sense, I think, when you were talking a moment ago, this idea of the pendulum, it does feel as though the pendulum is at the approaching the height of its arc in this in that direction. So obviously, you know, it everything at that point, things get super compressed because it's running out of momentum. So events get compressed.
Which country or state just approved bestiality for
You're joking.
I'm not. I was just reading something where basically it was like, basically, the whole idea was women fucking their dogs. Like a woman with a large dog is like basically banging their dog. And some story I read where it was basically affirmed or not made illegal anymore. I forget where
it was. Did you post something about that on Discord?
I don't think I did.
I remember coming across this somewhere. And it was being suggested that it was like a step on the way to legalizing pedophilia.
Yeah. I didn't post that, I don't think.
And what hell? What country? That is bizarre. How many women want to have sexual relations with their dog?
Apparently, according to statistics, more than you'd expect, like more than one. Some percentage that was.
I mean, you hear stories about blokes fucking their chickens and things like that, you know.
Sheep, you know, that whole. The Welsh and the Scottish, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Bestiality is legal in 4 states. Hawaii, what? Wyoming. Yeah. Bestiality may be legalized in EU state 4 days ago. Spain, that's where it was. Spain's Congress has approved new animal welfare law that decriminalizes zoophilia, provided the animals don't get injured. So if you're having anal with a sheep, as long as you don't tear the sphincter, I guess it's okay.
Oh, yeah.
Spain, that's where it is, yeah.
Nice. Good old sport. Well, Jason might be pleased to hear that. Who knows?
Yeah.
I shouldn't have said that, and that was a horrible comment.
It's all right.
I take it back. But the joke about the Welsh is, why do Welshmen wear oversized Wellington boots? So that they've got room to put the sheep's legs in.
Oh, I thought it was to catch all the cum overflow from the back. Too much?
I thought I was pushing it. Oh, dear me. Ah. Yeah, why not? The view from the gutter. Why not?
That's one thing I've actually feel sad about is in my obsession with staying on top of all the information lately and being on the cutting edge of knowing what's going on, I've lost my ability to be spontaneously funny and just joke in a careful
say
way.
Whatever the heck comes into your head. Yeah. Without fear of being
I can't do it anymore. Because now there's so much that I don't want to joke about because it's too serious. I used to think nothing was serious, and I understand that's a bit of an adolescent sort of attitude, but I do miss being an adolescent like that at times.
Oh, me too. Absolutely. Yeah. You've got to be able to say whatever you want to say and make a joke out of anything.
Yeah.
That's
why I like comedy clubs is because it just kind of reminds me of that more innocent time when you sing a good comic. They it's vicariously like I used to kind of be carefree like that guy up there, you know. I used to be able to just have a quick wit and joke about anything, and now things are off topic, not because I'm PC, but because I'm like, no, that's actually serious now, you know. It's but I guess that's part of growing older.
I still find that I really daft humor makes me laugh, and really risque humor still makes me laugh. And,
yes. Yeah.
You know,
I'm just not able to generate it like I used to be able to. I used to be a quicker wit and be able to get more of a laugh amongst people. Now I find that I'm not able to.
Yeah, I think you've got to read the territory better now. I think you've got to judge your audience quite carefully, and they're a tougher audience. And everyone's just like been just oversensitized to the possibility of being offended by something completely innocuous.
That's true.
That's why comedy's gone down the toilet. It's because everyone's just super sensitive about upsetting somebody.
Yeah. And even a comic like Carlin, he evolved over time and became much more serious, and his humor became much more sophisticated and politically sophisticated.
Yeah.
So it's part of growing older, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting how a lot of people I listen to quite often refer to Carlin, a famous quotation or something, you know, a skit that he did. So, you know, he's definitely relevant to the situation today, very much so.
And his last two specials were really cutting edge. And he told the truth so well.
that the one about germs is fantastic, isn't it? That riff about, I mean, how he memorized that material and can like that, just bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And the amount of drugs he did to still keep his head like that. That's the impressive part.
I didn't know that. Was he?
Oh, yeah. Big cocaine addiction for a while. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, he weaned himself off it, did he?
That's what he said. I mean, I don't know for sure. But yeah. I mean, he had a biography I read about him, or was some autobiography came out after he died. And he basically admitted to, like, especially his earlier days, when he was like the hippy dippy weatherman days, he was always whacked out on the coke.
But have you ever done trip?
Yeah. And it's fun for a while, and then it isn't. And that's what distinguishes it from other drugs is the sine wave of it.
Mm.
It's very high, and then crashes hard.
But is it physically addictive or just psychological?
To some. I've always been lucky in that the only thing that got me addicted was cigarettes. That I couldn't get off it. Booze was hard to get off booze, but everything else I was able to get off. Whereas like in college, I went through like three roommates who all ended up leaving school because they either went broke or just failed out of school from partying too much. But I was able to like walk away from it without too much trouble.
Oh, I'd love to have known you when you were right in the thick of it back then. See what you were like.
You may not have liked me.
Probably wouldn't you? But I would have been interested to see what you were like.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, yeah. I mean, I still keep in touch, though. People from college 40 years ago now reached out to me through – one of them became a cop, so I guess he found me through, like, his database connections. These cops all have special databases. But he found me, and I was reunited with a lot of these college guys. And so they still – they knew me at the height of my – maniacal stage, and I wonder if they would recognize me now, the person I've become since then.
Yeah, you can't be that radically different. You're just, you're more. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but
what's that line from Rush? Experience to extremes.
That's the song.
I don't know. I think it's from Grace Under Pressure. I forget. But
I know the lyrics. I know the lyrics of most songs up to Moving Pictures. And after that, I don't know the lyrics so well.
I'm not giving in to security under pressure. I'm not missing out on the promise of adventure. I'm not giving up on improbable dreams. Experience to extremes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's from Grace Under Pressure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Check it out.
I'll post it for you on the post meeting.
Would you?
Yeah.
Do that. Okay. Nice one. Yeah. Listen, it's going to be time to go soon.
Yes, indeed.
What's happening with you today? Have you got anything happening on your land?
I have been processing wood for the last couple of weeks. I've neglected my car, which is still on jack stands, because I've had to deal with the trees that were fallen and all the limbs. I only paid the guy $1,000 and he took down five trees, but he left all the trees because all the money is in the getting rid of the stuff. So in chopping up and then bucking them, I've learned, bucking the trees, then chopping the wood. I've got pretty much a split cord I've done myself by hand. And now I'm dealing with all the branches and the gnarly stuff. And I bought a chipper shredder that I've been feeding nonstop for the last few days. So I'm getting finally some progress. So that's what I've been doing mostly.
Is that a petrol-driven shredder?
Yes. Yeah.
So it's pretty powerful then.
It is, and yet still, I think actually I've worn out the blade where I might need to replace the blades already because I've put so much stuff through it already. I've created a lot of sawdust. But it's a great tool also for gardening because it turns all this stuff into compost.
Yes. And the thicker chips you can use as mulch, can't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It looks really nice, that sort of chipped wood as a mulch around your plants. Your wife will appreciate that, I'm sure.
Yes. Yeah. Do you find it
makes your wrists ache when you're trying to ram the stuff down into the chute?
Well, I've caught my fingers a couple of times because as the thing's coming in, it'll bang back and forth, and me trying to feed it, it'll slam against the wall of the chute, and my fingers in between. So I got a nice bruise on my thumb here, and a nice bruise on my ring finger here. Okay. So I've learned to get a little better at that. I'm learning a lot about this kind of stuff, and it's fun learning new skills like this.
You know, you'll be a properly naturalized Virginian man when you've got one permanently black fingernail that never recovers. You know, that'll be the sign.
Yeah, as long as I'm not four finger Harry or something like that. I don't want that. You know, that happening.
You know, you never reach too far down the chute to try and.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Believe me, I think about death every day, and I think about keeping on my limbs every day.
Yeah. Actually, you know, using those really powerful, like the chainsaw and the chipper, they're really good ways of reminding yourself about, you know, about the fragility of your own body.
Yeah. I don't want to, and I don't think I fear death, but I don't also want to invite it, and I also want to keep this body like a temple as long as I can, and keep everything running, all the parts running well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. But you're doing all the things right, man. You're doing a good job, you know. You're doing a good job with yourself.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. So far, so good. Yeah. Yeah, everything works.
Hold for steady. Let me count.
you've been there, done that. You're a veteran of the bucking and chopping and shredding.
Fair enough. Yeah. I honestly pride myself in saying I never had a worse mishap with the chainsaw than sharpening it, and the file would slip over the tooth, and you'd end up gouging a chunk out of your finger. But I never had anything worse happen than that.
Yeah, the sharpening of the chain, I'm still not confident I'm doing it correctly, even though I have the tool and I've seen the videos. It's not cutting right since the chain has gone through it. I got the guide to take down the rakers and all that. And I just feel like I'm not making the proper technique yet on it. I don't know what I'm doing wrong exactly.
I think you just, after a while, when I first started, we used to use the file guide. I don't know if it's the same thing, like you clamp the file into the guide and then the guide runs on the top of the tooth sets the depth of the file. We used to find that after a while, it was just easier just to do it by eye and by feel. Yes. You don't use the guide and you just use the vial on its own. Right. And you get a sense of what was the, you know,
Yeah.
It comes with time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I just haven't done enough. I've only sharpened the chain maybe, you know, less than 10 times. So I can't expect to be an expert at it yet. But based on the way it cut the last time after I sharpened it, I'm like, this is not where it needs to be. So I know I need to keep working on it. Yeah, but anyway,
the way a nicely sharpened chain goes through a log, you know, it's such a satisfying feeling.
Yeah, I only know that from a brand new chain. I don't know yet from a sharpened chain that I've done. So that's where I need to improve. But
well, you're in the right place to improve, aren't you? You're not going to run out of trees anytime soon.
No. Yeah. But all right, buddy. Have a good day. And good luck with the job starting on Monday.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, I'll tell you all about it next week.
Right.
Take care for now. Have a great weekend.
All right. Man.